And that's why I don't, I would think she would go sanitar.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the House Higher Education Committee. It is Thursday, January 19th, 2012. Welcome all. We promise you a fun-filled afternoon, certainly information-packed, hopefully a low level of angst and a high level of appreciation for the issues that we're going to be discussing. So what we're going to do is we're going to have public hearings on three of our committee bills first, one related to STEM, one related to higher education governance, university governance, one related to staffing reporting. And then we are going to go into work session to introduce all of our five committee bills as committee bills. And then we have information hearings on two subjects, one related to the work of the Student and Institutional Success Task Force, and then one following up on a conversation at our November hearing looking at some of the cost drivers in the costs of higher education. Okay. So we are going to open now. I'm going to open a public hearing on legislative concept LC 251. This is relating to the Task Force on STEM Access and Success. Victoria, would you like to walk us through this?
A bunch of electronic stuff. That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The measure establishes a task force on STEM, access and success, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics to assess the current status of Oregon STEM programs and identify opportunities for expansion improvement to include recruitment of previously underserved populations. Public-private partnerships and potential funding sources will also be explored by the task force. A state treasury fund will be established for purposes of allowing the Oregon Student Access Commission to accept grants and contributions for STEM education.
Thank you. So just as a bit of background, the committee last session heard a report on ETIC, you know, one of our great programs, and you're actually going to be hearing more about it in a moment. One of the things that jumped out at us, I mean, I remember it jumping out at me and I think some of the other committee members, was the fact that you know, many, if not most, of our engineering students in our Oregon universities are not actually coming up through the Oregon school system. They're coming from other states or, in many cases, other countries. And, you know, that is a real concern because we need, you know, STEM jobs, engineering jobs are, you know, vital to the state's economy. They're good-paying jobs. These are good pathways for our students. Why are they dropping it? Why are they dropping off the STEM track? And the purpose of this this bill is to try to address that and try to remove some of those barriers. Mark, do you have anything you want to add to this?
No, well, I think you've stated it very well, Mr. Co-Chair. It's an area that, again, as we talk about the transition, the seamlessness that we're trying to create between our K-12 system and our higher ed system, it makes sense to have a continuum that creates that initiative, that momentum, that connectivity to focus on science, technology, and so forth at a lower level that then can be the segue to a successful higher ed career, which can hopefully lead into a very successful employment opportunities as these students progress. So exciting. There's some very, very exciting things going on across the state. You'll hear about some of them today. And just as a segue into that, Representative Dembro and I will be having a roundtable discussion in Hood River this coming Monday to focus on that, because there's some incredibly exciting things going on in the Gorge that I'm hoping to hear from. Use it as a listening session, and then we can bring back our findings to even make this legislation even better. So thank you.
Okay, so let's call up our first panel. This first panel will be people addressing the ETIC, Education and Technology Industry Council. So I'd ask Bruce Schaefer and Art Johnson to come up, please.
Thank you. introduce yourself.
I'll be speaking second, but I'm Bruce Schaefer. I'm the Executive Director for the Engineering Technology Industry Council and a staff member of the Chancellor's Office of the University System.
I'm Art Johnson. I'm Vice President of KPFF Consulting Engineers in Portland, and I'm a Vice Chair of ETIC. I understand we have 20 minutes. We have about 10 minutes worth of things to say and leaving you some time for questions and answers. Some of the questions you may have from my presentation are things that we hope Bruce is addressing as well, but if you can interrupt any time you want if you have a question. There we go. ETIC was established in 1997 to help increase the quality of engineering and applied science programs in the OUS system. As I said, it was established in 1997. The big thing was to facilitate the investing of public funds in programs that are useful to industry. Not have a kid spend 4 years, get a degree in something where he can't find a job. And also to focus on investing in education so it serves industry's needs, so it helps both industry and the student. The current board, I don't recall how many members there are, but this is a list of 16. Some of the, oops, our computer went berserk. Different industries that are represented and a list of the firms that are represented on the board. There's some very large companies that all of you have heard of and some very small companies that probably none of you have heard of. We've also recently added one board member working for a construction company. They hire more and more engineers for the work that they do. I'm going to keep talking without the slides. The idea is to produce graduates who are work ready. You can start a job and be doing worthwhile work from the start. And having industry input into what that is certainly helps. These are high paying jobs, but also the intent is to bring money to the state through grants to the universities and money given by companies for research. When ETIC was first formed, where's your pyramid? There we go. The basic goal was to help the state and universities to determine where to best introduce both public and private funds and their resources. With a proper use of funding and adequate funding, we felt that the universities could be competitive in the world market. So the immediate goals were to double the number of engineering and computer science degrees that are given by OUS universities, and to increase the research grants by a factor of 5. So this is in 1997. In order to do that, it takes more than just improving the education system at the universities. We need good students entering the universities to attract them into engineering and science. It's good for them and it's good for the state as well. It's a little confusing chart or diagram, a little busy, but one thing it demonstrates is getting a degree in any one of these majors can lead to a career in all sorts of different areas. So if somebody doesn't come out of a university earmarked to design bioswales the rest of their career, unless they want to. ETIC provides funding to all 7 universities in the OUS system, plus some to Oregon Health Sciences University. This also indicates the number of programs that are covered in each of the institutions. Obviously, there's a lot more engineering program at OSU than there are at some of the other schools. It's a history of the both public and private money that's been put into the engineering program since ETIC was founded. If you notice, both public and private investments have increased 7 to 8 times over where they were in 1997. every public dollar generates about $1.70 in private funding, which is obviously good. So the number of engineering graduates, the aim was to double them in 1997. It's increased by about 60%. The number of engineering graduates have close to doubled. The computer science program has not grown as much as the engineering program has. And the actual research investments are almost 2.5 times what they were 12 years ago. And again, we feel that ETIC has had, and the money that the legislature has given us to distribute, has been a major factor in providing that. Bruce?
Thanks, Art. To the committee, first a confession and then a thank you. I left my office in Portland without a tie, and I need what a thanks to Jock Mills for loaning me his.
It's an orange and black tie.
Yeah, he knows the color scheme. From the beginning, ETIC knew that the pipeline was part of the problem, and it, as the years went on, it became more obvious that that was a key limiting factor. In 2005, we set up a new program, starting out with a two-day summit, bringing people together from a variety of areas to take a look at how we could deal with the shortage of young people that aspire to engineering, computer science, and the lack of diversity in those disciplines. We've created a program. It goes by its own name. I don't mention on these slides, but its short name is OPAS. That's short for Oregon Pre-Engineering and Applied Science. It's essentially the ETIC pre-college program, and you can see on this slide what its goals are. The overall strategy is to give hands-on experience to young people. One of the big problems that accounts for the lack of interest in preparedness is not every kid that goes into biology has a great biology teacher, but I'd say a majority do. Majority of kids that decide to go into chemistry had a great chemistry teacher. We've got about 20 computer science programs in the state out of about 200 high schools, and probably about 18 of them are great, but that leaves a lot that don't have them at all. Same for engineering. There's probably maybe 30 or 40 pre-engineering programs, but most kids have no opportunity to find out whether they like it or not. And that puts us way behind, because you can't decide as a junior to become an engineer in college. You need to know when you go in. So that's where we focus, on hands-on experiences. Most of our work is making little grants to schools and to nonprofits, and we ask them to create a systematic solution, or we help them grow one that already is systematic. We want it to be complete, sustainable, so that they won't require us there forever, and scalable, so that it doesn't require just one genius that's irreplaceable, but techniques and methods that can be spread across the state. Recently, we've re-upped our emphasis on computer science based on what Art mentioned, and that is that the traditional engineering disciplines are growing. Computer science is the laggard, and it's probably the most universal in its need for all industries. Our strategy is divided into in-class, out-of-school time, sometimes referred to as OST, and marketing. And in class, we want to grow the number of rigorous pre-engineering and computer science programs in Oregon's middle schools and high schools, and enhance the implementation of Oregon's K-12 science standard. Oregon is one of the few states in the country that includes engineering design in the science standards, but it's a very young addition to that standard, and a lot of work needs to be done to complete the implementation of that standard. When it comes to out-of-school time, our strategy is to increase availability of high-quality team-based and project-based. These are things that are hard to do in school, even with money. They tend to be easier to do outside of school time, where there's less structure and more opportunity for open-ended problem-solving. To help do that, we provide incentive grants to schools and share in the cost of stipends to teachers to stay after school and serve as engineering coaches. In the marketing area, we strive to provide communication that is informative to K-12 students and the adults in their life, whether they be counselors, teachers, or parents, that influence their thinking. We want to provide information both about college disciplines and professional careers so they can make informed decisions. Our budget is a small part of the ETIC budget, the Bynum budget for ETIC. Used to be 38 through a series of budget cuts. It's now down to 27.5. About 800,000 goes for these three programs. So there's a lot more we could be doing if there were more resources, and that might speak to one of the goals of the bill being considered today. When it comes to private money, an example of private support is the statewide robotics programs. You'll hear more about them later today, but I wanted to connect the dots when it comes to ETIC and its goals. Oregon Robotics Tournament Outreach Program is a program of the university system, but we didn't invent it. It was invented by FIRST in New Hampshire, and you'll hear about it more generally today. It has four programs. ORTOP deploys three of those in Oregon and Southwest Washington, known as Junior FIRST LEGO League, FIRST LEGO League, and FIRST Tech Challenge. FIRST LEGO League is probably the best known, perhaps because it's one of the largest. But Junior FIRST LEGO League is actually a predecessor, was added a few years ago for kids in first, second, and third grade. They don't actually have to build robots, but they do start with a Lego kit and a rather challenging science theme that almost always mirrors the theme of the older program. This year it was food. The kids are to go out and learn about food safety and create a display about what they learned. So they get started pretty young doing teamwork and learning about science. This year we have 90 teams. We'll have two expos, and we'd like to thank OMSI for hosting those expos. FIRST LEGO League is for kids from 4th to 8th and sometimes 9th grade. It's based on a Lego robotics kit where the kids program autonomous robots. When the robots are moving around on the 4x8 playing field, there's no remote control. It's all programmed by the kids, and they program sensors so the robot knows where it's going and when it's reached a particular place and needs to make that left turn and keep going. They push, pull, lift, retrieve, and deliver objects based on the annual theme. Again, this year had to do with food safety, so they're collecting bacteria, cleansing things, and otherwise dealing with food safety. We have one of the largest programs in the country. Per capita, Alaska and Hawaii beat us because of their relatively small populations, but other than that, we think they're the largest in the country on a per capita basis with 426 teams. To handle that number of teams, we have 24 qualifying events around the state, from Hood River to Portland to Medford and Bend, and then we bring together the top 20 or 30% of those teams for a pair of championships each year, hosting about 120 teams. Quotes from some of the teams, team members for that championship that occurred just last weekend are on screen. I won't read them to you. By semi-coincidence, the first two are young men from Hood River, Oregon, and the other two from another team.
Wow.
I mentioned that the science thing, they do a team science project as well as design the robot. And here are the names of some science projects out of the over 400 that were done this year. I'll know you're reading it when I hear you chuckle about number three. Yeah. FIRST Tech Challenge is a high school program, one of two high school programs. This combines both autonomous robotics and remote control robotics for maximum excitement and gameplay and a lot of sophistication in programming. There's both offensive and defensive aspects. The teams also develop an engineering notebook because they go through a full engineering cycle just like the FIRST LEGO League teams do, only on a more sophisticated level. 85 teams in Oregon. This is a younger program that's still one of the largest in the country with six qualifying events and a championship. I should mention that our championships for convenience are in the Portland area, and we'd like to thank Hillsborough School District for hosting them, both FIRST LEGO League and FIRST Tech Challenge. Chris Steiner's in the audience. Thanks, Chris. So in summary, 4,200 students are served by these three programs. The program costs are $230,000. The teams also raise money, $500 to $1,000 for FIRST LEGO League and a couple hundred thousand dollars for FIRST Tech Challenge. So the total cost for three programs serving 4,200 kids is about $600,000, and almost all of that comes from private sources. Certainly all of our $230,000 budget comes from private sources. The reason we can do that with so few dollars is volunteers. Coaches, technical mentors, judges, referees, tournament volunteers make it happen. There's basically only one full-time staff person focused on those three programs in the state. So we've got some additional material if you have questions, but I think we're both ready to take questions, time permitting.
Yes, Rep. Lindsay.
See if you can delay that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming down. This is great. One question, though, is before I came to the legislature, I never heard of ETIC. And I represent Intel World, Hillsboro, right? Now, my kids are elementary. I don't have any high school kids. But I guess my question is, why? How can we get this more out there? How can we market this? Mm-hmm. I think I'm a pretty informed guy. I do, mm-hmm. I do intellectual property stuff. Never even heard of it.
But, thank you. And Co-Chair Johnson and Gumbro and Representative Lindsay, we struggled with that at a two-day strategic retreat at the end of September, that and several other issues. And we've since formed a Communications and Strategic Partnerships Committee to work on that. Like a lot of things, you tend to be known where you touch, and historically been focused on the university level, so we're well known by our universities and by the people that are involved in engineering, but we're totally unknown outside of that. The Lego Robotics is known mm-hmm. in a lot of places, but the connection to ETIC is probably unappreciated maybe until today. So we've got a lot of work to do, and it's going to need to be targeted. The way to solve it in mass is to run an expensive television advertising campaign, so I don't think we're going to do that. I think we're going to target where we enhance our communication and our partnerships.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, could you talk a bit about how the private sector resources are leveraged? How do you turn X number of dollars into more money over here?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Early on, there was a notion that ETIC would form a pool, and all the money would go into a pool, and then it would come out. But it turned out to be much more effective to have the state money go into the pool, have ETIC advise the university system on how to allocate that primarily to the campuses. Almost all of it goes directly to the campus, with the exception of the money I showed you earlier. And then we put the campuses on the hook to recruit the private money, forecast it, and report at least annually to ETIC on how they're doing on that. And historically, in every biennium in aggregate, they've exceeded. We've had a couple campuses fall short and made up by some other campuses, but generally they've done well at meeting those forecasts. To your question, the state dollars tend to go towards salaries, and the private dollars tend to go towards equipping labs, buildings, scholarships, fellowships, and the combination is pretty powerful.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
As we fast forward then into STEM, can you envision a system for private sector investment that, again, could be leveraged in some way, but now you're talking about instead of seven OUS institutions, you're talking about 190 six or seven school districts.
Right.
Can you envision a methodology? And I'm not putting you on the spot, but
yeah,
maybe you've got some thoughts about that.
Representative Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, I think that's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
The campuses that are most successful at recruiting private dollars are the big ones that have foundations associated with them and well-established relationships, particularly with alumni. Nationwide, the most successful programs often target alumni. It's a lot harder to go back to target your elementary school alumni for donations, although it's certainly worth a try. But there are companies that are willing to step up. If you had asked me 2 years ago whether Google would step up in your area, I would say no. Why would they? It's a server farm. They're going to need 20, 30 techs and five engineers. But they have stepped up when it comes to robotics, and I think more companies were willing to step up, both because it's the right thing to do and because there's a certain amount of shaming we can do when we point out the ones that are.
Hmm. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really questions, but comments. Thank you for being here. Thank you for all this work. I really love these programs. I think we should do everything we can to support them. I, until very recently, owned a software business, a tech business that I started.
Very recently.
I would question the statements that say we don't want to send a kid through 4 years of college and have them come out with a degree that's not worth something. Some of my best, I have wonderful employees mm-hmm. who are CS undergrad and grad programs. One of my very best employees and a programmer didn't go to college, taught himself everything, mm-hmm. is an independent filmmaker and a killer guitarist. Mm-hmm. All right? So I want to give you guys all the support we possibly can, and I want to do the same thing for arts schools.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rick Parker. I have one question. You know, Bruce, you mentioned, or Art mentioned, diversity as one of the challenges with STEM. If we have an achievement gap in general, you know, in our schools, we have a huge achievement gap with respect to STEM, kids who go into STEM education. Just the other day, I heard about a new initiative called the National Minority STEM Initiative. I wonder what we are doing as a state to date, you know, what, if anything, ETIC is doing to really focus on getting more minority students interested in STEM, involved in STEM activities inside and outside of school, and then ultimately entering the pipeline into college.
Well, I guess I'll take that one. Co-Chair Dembrough and Co-Chair Johnson, there's a lot more that needs to be done because the issues are deep and wide, but there are at least two things that we are doing and need to expand upon. One is when ETIC makes these investments, it goes through a competitive RFP process, and one of the criteria is to what extent is the proposal and the proposing organization set up to serve and attract diverse audiences. And we ask them for demographic information both up front and in regular reports. Another has to do with emphasis. The rather long name for the robotics program here in Oregon, Oregon Robotics Tournament and Outreach Program, that second O, is about diversity both in gender, ethnicity, and economic. And we do at least two things that lead to some success there. One is emphasize it in training coaches. We provide free training to coaches. When a cul-de-sac team is forming, we challenge them to find kids that maybe are outside the cul-de-sac to join the team. We encourage both teams that are boys and girls, and girls-only team by working with organizations like Boys and Girls Club and 4-H and Girl Scouts. We haven't reached 50% when it comes to girls yet, but we're at about 30%, and the program's growing, so it's serving more girls every year. And similarly with ethnic minorities. So it takes a lot of tenacity to deal with these issues.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony and for teeing us up, really, for the next panel, because you talked a lot about OST. That's a term I never heard before, out-of-school time. But I think we all know that to get more kids into the STEM pipeline, it involves activities not just in school, but maybe primarily outside of school. So to that end, we have a first robotics panel.
Can I pull a chair up?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. We have a cadre of voices for you this afternoon, so thank you. And we will keep it to our 20 minutes. I've given everybody 4 minutes each. Thank you so much, Bruce, for giving a great intro and overview and to first and kind of letting you guys know what we do, and then know that there's another high school program that fits over that as well. And so we'll speak to the dollars in a minute. So thank you so much for taking time and allowing us to come and speak to you today, and just really talk about how STEM is so critical in K through 12, as it starts there to get to the higher ed, to get into the pipeline. My name is Deborah Mumhill. I am the first Pacific Northwest director for FIRST, so I cover the states of Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, but I live here in the great state of Oregon and have 4 kids and some who are in college but private, or who were in public schools. So just to kind of give you, to tag on what Bruce did, we are a nonprofit workforce development program that spans K through 12, engaging kids in STEM learning through project-based high-energy robotics, and Bruce did a fantastic job. We have a 16 $1 million college scholarship fund from over 140 universities who are putting their own cash on the table. We don't put a dollar into that fund. It is those universities' cash who are trying to matriculate our first students onto their campus because they know that they are getting a very motivated STEM student who already knows the career that they're going to attain at the end. Currently, you guys know the stats. There's over 2 million unfilled jobs in the United States, and there's 18 million unemployed Americans. And the two shall never meet because those 2 million jobs are in high tech and healthcare, and the 18 million unemployed are not trained or educated or have experience or aptitudes in STEM that would be required to fill those jobs. And so FIRST is one of those programs that absolutely goes after that issue. We implement our programs because a student's world is only as big as their community or school can show them. So if a child dreams of working at Google or Facebook but has never met a cloud computing software analyst, how will she ever get there? So what we do is we bring industry professionals, some of those who will speak today, directly into the schools, and we create an internship and broaden a child's knowledge of cutting-edge technologies. We very much heighten their awareness of the tech jobs that are in the state and in their own zip code. And the big thing is then they have the reality check of the mastery that they will need to have in STEM subjects to get to those jobs. And what happens is they choose to engage in their own education to the best of their ability of what the K-12 system offers them. The professional development happens organically, and the outcome is we're filling the STEM pipeline of students, and at the same time, we're energizing and informing teachers of the relevance of the rigor that they are teaching in the classroom and how that's going to apply to jobs that are changing so quickly exponentially with the technology that's out there. So Bruce gave you some stats of our three of our programs, but I'm just going to talk overall first in the state. So this year, we will have over 5,000 Oregon students in STEM, 4th through 12th grade. We know statistically 88% of them will go to a four-year institution, and of those, 55% will pursue a career in science or engineering. So what we need is for K-12 to better prepare our youth with more STEM curriculum, and then for higher ed to be aware of this tidal wave that we are going to be sending your way very, very soon. Our nation and our state can't afford the weeding out of these students because of restricted class size in the universities or from unpreparedness in certain degrees like engineering, biomedical, healthcare, and computer science. An example that we learned this past year in Washington, which is an area I cover, is that 5 years ago we had 900 students in FIRST programs, and this year we'll have over 6,000. Washington State University's mechanical engineering freshman enrollment this year was 250, and they only have slots for 80. So programs like FIRST have to have a seat at the table with higher ed and workforce development so that we can help you be proactive in responding to what's coming out of the K-12 programs, because when you have programs like ours that are absolute needle movers, it's going to affect us all, and we all have to work together to get to that final outcome. Thankfully, with a little budge from knowing, Governor Gregoire proposed $9.8 million recently to the budget to triple the slots of engineering and computer science programs at UW and WSU, and is prioritizing in-state enrollment versus out-of-state slots, which we know allows for higher revenues in our universities when it's out-of-state tuition, but it shuts out local students. So part of that $9.8 million will be to gap that revenue gap and allow Washington students in the state schools. She is absolutely making it a priority to keep companies like Boeing and Microsoft in the state and allowing for students to have the first shot at filling those very high-wage jobs. This past session in June, the Oregon legislature allocated $150,000 to start FIRST robotics teams in the school. So I absolutely thank every one of you in this room and in this building today for that. So what did we do with that? In 3 weeks, during the month of July, when no teachers were in-house, we set out a grant and received over 92 applications in 3 weeks. We granted 76, and we added 21 more high schools to our roster in rural areas that we never were able to reach before, like Brookings and Vernonia, Kay Falls, Molalla, Colton, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Coquille, Glide, Gilchrist, Halfway, Sherman, and Umatilla, to just name a few. And because we have such strong industry support, we turned your $150,000 investment into a 4.1 return in 4 weeks. And we will continue to leverage that investment to a 6-to-1 investment by the end of this June. So over $1.2 million from industry will be given to our state schools, showcasing a premier private-public partnership model that works, that moves the needle, and that fills the pipeline. So in Oregon, we feel there currently is not enough understanding or support of the importance of STEM in K-12. So us at FIRST and our industry partners feel a task force will allow parties involved, or should allow parties involved from education, industry, and effective STEM programs like FIRST to convene in order to be proactive rather than reactive as we build momentum of the STEM education pipeline. We are in support of legislative concept 251. So FIRST is doing a great work in K-12, and we are asking the legislature to carry it through to completion, because there is future and a hope and a job out there for every one of our students who pursues a STEM career. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Roxy Hecker.
Thank you very much, Deb.
Good afternoon. Co-Chairman Dembro and Johnson, members of the House Education Subcommittee, I'm thrilled to be here this afternoon to be able to talk to you about a subject I'm very passionate about, and Autodesk, the company I'm here representing, is also very passionate about. I'm going to talk a little bit about who Autodesk is, because despite our size, a lot of people don't know who we are, and I'm going to talk a lot about why we believe and why we support FIRST so heavily. A little bit about Autodesk. We are a world leader in 3D design, engineering, software, gaming, and film. 16 consecutive last Academy Awards for visual effects used our software. Almost every car designed in the world, with the exception of a few in Russia, were designed using our software. We design iPods, industrial machinery, I should say our customers do. Everything from special effects in movies like Avatar to buildings that generate their own energy to the batteries that help generate that energy are designed by using our software by our amazing set of customers. So our customers tend to be almost everywhere you look. In Oregon, Autodesk is organized in 4 divisions. Worldwide, we have about 7,000 employees in 95 countries across the world. We are truly a diverse company. We have 4 divisions. The manufacturing division is headquartered here in Lake Oswego, Oregon. We've consistently been rated as among the 100 best companies to work for in Oregon, and this morning we announced, very excited, we were voted the 52nd favorite best company to work for in the country. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of that. In Oregon, we directly employ 175 people. These are typically engineers, designers, documentation people, and managers. Our sales force is not included in these numbers. To Representative Harker's perspective, it's not just the science, it's the art of building software that creates a good product. Our employees enjoy a very strong salary and benefits package. Our median salary in Oregon is $113,000. That is nearly double the median family income in the three counties that our employees are primarily represented in. The Census Bureau for 2009 shows that those 175 jobs translate into 585 additional positions for home purchasing power, translating to $44.5 million of a labor footprint of Autodesk in Oregon. So now I hope next time somebody asks who is Autodesk, we have a bit of a better understanding. Most people don't. I'm really here to talk a bit about my personal experience with FIRST. I became involved with FIRST about 10 years ago, actually with FIRST Lego League that you heard Bruce talking about, the little Legos. And I got involved because I realized that there is this stage at which girls start feeling like being smart is not cool. It happens statistically about 8th grade. And as a person who doesn't have children, I felt like there was something I could and should do to help contribute to that solution. Since then, I moved on to the high school students, which is a little more aggressive and interesting, but I keep coming back. I keep coming back to FIRST because of the stories I see of students who make you want to cry, make you proud, make you want to hug them, or make you want to slap them. And anybody who's had children, I think it's a mix of all of those.
That's the 1 hour after dinner.
Last year, Autodesk was involved in filming a promotional video try to encourage high-tech companies to allow their employees to mentor teams and to try to talk about the importance of that. One of the students that we filmed in that video is a homeless student who believed college was not in her future, that she was doomed to be a statistic. Through her involvement in FIRST, she not only believes that she will go to college now, and I'm sure she will, but she will make her career choice based on that exposure. I alluded earlier, part of my involvement was seeing young girls in particular start believing that being smart, particularly in STEM, could be cool. I was a biology and a chemistry major in college. We were the definition of the uncool kids. It's brilliant and exciting to start seeing boys respond to young girls who are smart and who are in technology careers. Students typically today they're not exposed to engineers. Their engineers are not on the cover of People magazine. They're not on the cover of Sports Illustrated. There's very few reality shows that feature smart engineering type people. Programs like FIRST are the kinds of tools that let those students get that exposure, not only to engineering as a possible career option, but people who can mentor them. Exposure to people who are program managers, people who are engineers, people who are designers. Autodesk has 150 of their employees who currently donate volunteer time. Autodesk allows employees to take paid time off from work to do volunteer activities. FIRST is our primary one that we focus on in Oregon. Specifically here in Oregon, I should take a step back for a moment. Autodesk sponsors FIRST on a nationwide basis. Specific to Oregon, however, in the last 12 months, we've donated over $200,000 directly to the Oregon Regional and to help sponsor individual teams. One of my favorite statistics is over 2,000 hours of employee time has been donated to mentor, train, referee. My personal involvement is I'm a referee. I love being on the field where all the action's happening and the energy is high and emotions are high. Our employees do volunteer for those roles. We judge students' websites. We've donated over $1 million in our software. We make our software available for free for all students. Autodesk is also big in hiring college interns. Here in Oregon, we decided to pilot a program where we started hiring high school interns. So a few summers ago, we hired 7 FIRST high school interns. Last year, we did 7 as well. This year, we're hoping to hire 10. Those are the most productive interns we have. Side by side, we had one of my favorite high school interns from FIRST come back for a second year. He was more productive than the Stanford MBA student we had doing a similar job working right next to him. We felt like we got more out of our money for that. FIRST is primarily our major philanthropic focus in the state of Oregon. You know, I think it goes without saying we need more trained engineers in the state. What I have started to realize through some really practical examples at Autodesk is it's more urgent than I thought. We're currently hiring engineers in San Francisco. As you can imagine, we pay a lot more for an engineer in San Francisco. And we're doing that because we cannot find people with the right experience and skill set here in Oregon. It's not just an engineering degree. It has to be the right mindset. It has to be the right approach, the ability to work effectively on a team. All of these things are things that FIRST Robotics teaches these students. And we would absolutely hire a student out of college with a FIRST background over an experienced person with the wrong background. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Perry Moore.
I work for the Boeing Company, where I'm the plant manager for our site in Gresham. I'm also the chair for our FIRST Robotics Executive Advisory Board. I'd like to thank Representatives Dembro and Johnson for allowing us to come and share our thoughts today, as well as the rest of the committee for listening to us. In Gresham, we employ about 1,700 people. And those are all a mix of hourly machinists and engineering and technical people. And FIRST is one of those things that, as Boeing, we look at as a way to prepare young people as a step forward to move into engineering and science degrees. We need to continue to encourage students to move forward into that, and FIRST allows them to get to that stage very quickly. One of the things that FIRST does is it really ties excitement, practicality, and STEM activities all together. When I first became engaged with FIRST, I'd never been to anything that brought as much excitement to me personally watching it to that point in my career. And it's really the things that they do together with the technology, the business, the marketing, the competition that all brings that together. In Boeing this year, we hired about 16,000 people in 2011. About half of those were for new positions, and about half of them were replacement. We expect to hire about another 30,000 people over the next 4 years as we go through time. In Gresham, we hired 300 people this year, and we'll hire about 100 more each year going forward. So it's really critical to us to have a good, sound supply of strong technical and innovative people as we go forward. Boeing has a national four-year partnership with FIRST that we've put together, which is valued at about $4 million. And the innovative part of that relationship is that to get the money to the FIRST students, we do it through a series of grants, and those grants are given based upon the fact that there's a Boeing employee that's a mentor on those different FIRST teams. So the employees bring not only money with them, which is pretty exciting for the students, but it also brings something more than that. Money alone is not going to make kids enthused about STEM. It takes people to do that, and our mentors come in there with a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of practical knowledge, and they can have the one-on-one discussions with those students about how the relationship between what they're doing in FIRST, their science and math classes, tie back to a real career out in the real world. And so that's where we see the leverage of making that tie together and getting more of a contribution than just money. FIRST assists in five critical areas to support kids in the classroom. Kids need real-world, hands-on, practical skills and experiences to grow those. And that's one of the things that FIRST does, both from a design perspective, a programming perspective, actually making things. We have a number of students that we bring in from various teams into our apprenticeship lab. It's a machine shop, basically, and allow them to use that to build their robots. So they're actually hands-on out there running machines. So a lot of these kids, whether they end up going to university or not, still can see a practical application of the math and science, even if it's in a high-tech machining world like what we do in Gresham. Kids also learn in school when they can relate to what the subject is that they're being taught. So after they go through an exercise through the FIRST program, you know, suddenly all that math and science makes a lot more sense. And so they're going to be paying a lot more attention and learning a lot better as they do that. They need role models. They need mentors. And that's part of what comes out of this through the coaches and the mentors that we provide, is it gives them something to lean on other than their parents and friends as they start talking about careers and their futures. They also need incentives and motivations to do better. And the way that FIRST is framed being a competition, it provides that incentive. And if you ever have a spare Saturday that you want to go get some enthusiasm and excitement, there is nothing more exciting than that. It's better than any NBA game or soccer match that you've ever seen. In closing, I just say that it's important that the state for state and business to work together to develop better STEM programs and more grads. As you can tell from the things just within Boeing that we're doing for hiring in the future, we've got to continue to work that pipeline. We've got to build it so, as you said, we can get those in-state students that are the ones that are graduating from those programs and they come to work for the companies here locally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Perry. And before we go on to Mary, I just want to say a couple of weeks ago I went to the kickoff for this year's robotics competition. I agreed to do it. You know, when it was mentioned to me, I was very excited. Then when it was mentioned that it was at 6:45 up in Vancouver, I was a little less excited. But once I entered the room, there was so much excitement in that room. And, you know, I have to say that I have to confess, I hadn't heard about Autodesk before. Sorry about that, Roxy. But every time Autodesk was mentioned in that presentation, there were cheers, and I mean, these kids definitely know about Autodesk, and so that energy really is infectious, as you say. Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, thanks. Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
You said you hired how many jobs in Grissom?
About 300 over the past year.
Were you able to fill them with Portland candidates? I mean, how did you do
a lot of Portland candidates, but we hire from all over, so it's a mix. And I don't off the top of my head know the percentage, but we hire as much locally as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mary.
Hi, my name is Mary Steiner, and I'm a senior in high school at Arts and Communications Magnet Academy and the business leader for FIRST Robotics Competition Team 1510, based out of Westview High School, which is also in Beaverton. I'd like to thank Representative Dembro and Representative Johnson and the rest of the committee for hearing what we have to say today. I was first approached by FIRST Robotics Competition Team 1510 a little bit over a year ago while I was volunteering at a FIRST LEGO League tournament. I ate lunch with them, and I told them that I had an interest in going into a business career, and they were telling me about all the opportunities available to business students through FIRST Robotics Competition. So there are opportunities for students not only interested in engineering, but also interested in accounting, marketing, web design, human resources, and all sorts of other areas. When I said I would join the team, I had absolutely no idea what I was getting myself into. Being that I go to an arts-focused school, I'm getting lots of information about design, and my creative skills are there, but there's less focus in my science and technology classes. I never got to choose which science classes I was going to take, so I had less enthusiasm in the classes because I saw no real world application. But this all changed when I joined robotics. Robotics showed me how the things that I learned in my classes, such as physics equations, could be applied in real-life situations. Another main mission of FIRST is to make being an engineer cool. Celebrities such as Will.i.am, Stephen Colbert, and Morgan Freeman are huge supporters of FIRST. Our team was lucky enough to go to the World Championships last year, and we got to go to a Black Eyed Peas concert and stand stage side at this Black Eyed Peas concert that was just for robotics competing teams. So nothing beats that. Now when I tell people about what I do, I introduce myself as a self-proclaimed robot nerd. And when I tell people about all of the opportunities I've gotten through FIRST and all of the amazing things I've been able to do, people don't see this as a negative thing, and I've even recruited a lot of my very close friends to be a part of the team. I'm also able to work with amazing mentors through the team who are able to give me information, anything from career advice to how to build a superstructure on a robot. I've learned how to do things like write grants, three which I have helped win for our team, fundraise, market a product, and manage a schedule. And even though I was in charge of tasks such as these, being submerged into an engineering environment introduced me to manufacturing, programming, computer animated design, and other elements of engineering. The more I experimented with these things, the more I realized how much of an interest in engineering that I had. Being on the FIRST Robotics team has also greatly improved my self-esteem. I feel like I'm a part of a team that's doing amazing things. During build season, I spend 40 hours or more shop during a week. And during the off-season, I spend close to that at outreach events, club meetings, and leadership meetings. Never during the entire year I've been involved in robotics have I felt like this was a chore or something I didn't want to do. I have always been so excited and energized to go to these robotics meetings. Before I joined robotics, I was planning on being a wedding planner. Now, yes, now I have been admitted and am very excited to attend Oregon State University as a pre-industrial engineering major next year. I'm very excited to partake in the MECOP internship program, hopefully, and I plan on working as an industrial engineer for a few years and then eventually going on to get my master's in business administration. Joining FIRST Robotics Competition Team 1510 has completely changed my life. Before joining this team, I had not ever even considered going into a career in engineering. It wasn't anywhere on my mind. And being on Team 1510 has given me experience working in a real-world engineering project. Now I'm beyond excited to go into a high-demand career field that I already know that I love.
Thank you very much, Mary. Yes, Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I had heard of Autodesk. I told Representative Hunt here that I'm a CAD-CAM attorney.
Oh.
And unfortunately, I've been in lots of legal disputes with Autodesk. I've been down in San Rafael several times taking depositions. But let's see, I guess it was, I can't remember when this was, the President's Jobs Council came to Portland.
Yeah.
And two things struck me that I heard down there at that conference. Number one was that for every engineer that America produces, Asia pumps out 30. Now, my counter was it's probably a complete reverse for lawyers. Every lawyer that they pump out, we pump out probably 30, way too many. So that struck me. The second thing that struck me was that there was an OSU graduate, engineering graduate, there that had graduated and could not find a job, and he told stories about a lot of other students, that recent graduates, that could not find jobs. And he came up and he said that after the fact that someone stated that we cannot find properly trained people to fill those jobs. And I just heard that statement here again, that you cannot fill some of those jobs. And so my question is we've got these students, recent grads, that are saying, we've graduated, we're qualified, we can't find the work, and we're saying, then we're hearing another story, we can't find them. What's the difference?
I'll answer that one. So FIRST students are highly employable just because they're 10 times more likely to have an internship in their freshman year in college. And right now, the statistics that we're watching is they're getting internships their freshman and sophomore year, and they're not going back to industry. My son's good friend did an internship at Twitter. He's making big money. He's going to follow, you know, finish his college education later. There's just a difference between a student who has had a high school experience that has showed them project management, leadership, and all of that. And I don't know if these were FIRST students or not, but so many of these FIRST students, because they've had mentors from industry from anywhere from 8 years of their life to 4 or 3, have an absolute tap into that industry. They have access to Perry, they have access to Roxy, where they can say, can you help us? And these companies have jobs. And so that's where I think a lot of times in some of these, I think MECOP is an awesome program, that these kids need to have that access, that personal access in the state to the employers that are in these programs. These guys can speak to it more. I don't know how many applications they get for a software engineer or an aerospace engineer, but you have to have something on that on that resume that is going to jump. And a lot of times, we all know this, we've all been in jobs and industry, it's that personal connection. And so we allow that.
And Mr. Chair, maybe as a follow-up, when you do answer, would it be accurate to say then that that you need to grease the skids somehow to get a job instead of just the certificate, instead of just the graduate, the BS degree? You need to have several years of networking in place in order to land that first job.
Yes, Representative Lindsay, that's absolutely correct. You know, we get thousands of people that apply for every position that we have, you know, from hundreds to thousands. And so, you know, you've got to have something that sets you apart to get a job. And something like FIRST, where you've got practical experience, is going to set you up to get an internship, which then you're coming into a full-time position already with some experience. And those are the things that we look at to set things aside. So community service, you know, all of the normal things that you would look at, are the things that people have to do. And oftentimes when I talk to students who, you know, say, I haven't been able to get a job, what I find is they haven't taken the initiative throughout their college career to do the other things that they need to add to that degree. And so they become, you know, lower on the list of potential candidates because of that.
Okay, thank you. We have one other person who's on this panel, although you can't see her. She's on the phone, and that's Heidi Seip from Umatilla. Heidi, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, could you go ahead?
Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. Though icy roads have prevented me from attending in person, mm-hmm. please know that I am fully committed to this topic, and I appreciate your time. I serve as the superintendent of the Umatilla School District, but I'm also a volunteer mentor for the Umatilla FIRST Robotics Team. The Umatilla School District is a rural district serving one of the poorest student populations in Oregon, with 83.5% of our K-12 student body qualifying for free or reduced lunch. The majority of students in Umatilla are Hispanic, and many are English language learners. Our district is committed to building successful futures for students, and we see STEM as a large component of future student success. Mm-hmm. In rural areas, jobs are limited and career opportunities are often narrowly defined. Mm-hmm. College is a foreign concept to many students, and they don't often view themselves as college material. It is essential for students to be exposed to a variety of career options so they can fully consider a path that will lead to their success. While our community is full of wonderful people, few adults within our boundaries are college educated. Census data reveals that only 6.2% of the adults over age 25 in Umatilla have attained a bachelor's degree or higher education level. Often, the only college educated professionals in our children's lives are educators. With this background, how can I, as a superintendent, ensure that my students are exposed to careers they've never even heard of, let alone imagine themselves to become? Fortunately, through programs like FIRST. Thanks to a grant from the state of Oregon, our high school has started a FIRST robotics team. The support from the state allowed us to start the program and leverage additional support through Autodesk, JCPenney, and NASA grants. 23 students were 35% female and 61% Hispanic. In grades 9 through 12, completed 20 hours of training during November and December to qualify for our team. Now, during our build season, they are participating each evening from 5 to 8 p.m. and each Saturday from 9 to 4 p.m. in hopes of successfully creating a robot for competition in March. This program has literally changed the lives of many of our students. From the beginning, we have emphasized professionalism, and each session we show the students YouTube videos of other teams or show them videos of paid professionals doing the same type of work. As mentors, we work to emphasize college options and the multitude of jobs that exist in STEM areas. Our work builds interest, but the FIRST kickoff event really sealed the deal for our students. At the FIRST kickoff, our students were able to interact with professional engineers and start to understand the importance of STEM fields. More importantly, our students realize that STEM professionals aren't just people they hear about or see the things they make on TV, but they're actual people who are fun to visit with and will share their skills. There were students coming up to me throughout the day saying, "Did you know that people get paid to do this and a lot of money?" And I can't accurately describe the joy on their faces as they learn of this whole new world of possibility available to them. As we work on our robot, today as soon as the ice thaws and we can get back into our shop, our students are striving to behave as the professionals they met. They no longer refer to what they're doing as working toward a robot. They know they're building a project that will open doors to their futures. Students who were once thinking about jobs as day laborers are calling themselves structural engineers and learning to read blueprints to build accurately. Students who sat at home and played video games are calling themselves programmers and learning how to write code. We have marketers making web pages, writing press releases, editing videos, electrical engineers learning circuitry, designers using 3D plan drawings to bring their visions to life. These are our team members right now. They know they have potential, they've seen the job markets available to them, and they know that FIRST is a way for them to build skills and secure the scholarships that will make their dreams reality. My students are now looking specifically at their programs of interest when selecting colleges, instead of thinking a college would never select them. FIRST is a bridge to their futures. Thank you for your support of FIRST and of STEM. The jobs of tomorrow haven't been invented yet, but my students will be ready. The designers, the engineers, and the marketers of tomorrow, we need to ensure that all students in Oregon have access to STEM and activities to ensure Oregon is ready for the future tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the work you're all doing to make that happen.
Thank you very much, Heidi, for that inspiring testimony, really. And panel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your coming and testifying.
For all you're doing for it.
I'd like to call up our last panel on this bill, and it is two people to talk about the metro area, the Oregon STEM Center. This is Morgan Anderson, our good friend from Intel, and Bill Becker from PSU.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stenbrough and Johnson and members of the committee. Before I get too far. First of all, my name is Morgan Anderson. I'm Intel's Higher Education and Government Affairs Manager for Intel. And I was thrilled to hear Mary's testimony because she mentioned Will.i.am, and he's actually an employee of Intel. If you can believe it, he's our Director of Innovation. And when we made that hire, most of our engineers and myself had to look him up and find out who he is. So apparently it was a very inspiring hire for the younger generation. He's a Black Eyed Peas singer, yes, and very engaged with FIRST and high tech, and he works part-time for Intel now. The second thing I wanted to share, I just looked it up. We had our earnings announcement this afternoon, and high tech is thriving, and Intel's doing very well. We announced record-breaking year of $54 billion, which is up from $43 billion last year. So there's growth opportunities for engineers right here in Oregon. Well, thank you for this opportunity to talk a little bit about Intel's experience and highlight our support of LC251. I look around the room, I see all sorts of partners who have worked years, if not decades, trying to advance education and particularly STEM in the state. And we all have the same goals and aspirations. We want more Oregon students qualified and ready to be hired by our Oregon companies. Intel's been in Oregon since 1974 when we bought land here, and we came here for a number of reasons, but one of which was that there was already the beginnings of a high-tech cluster. Tektronix was a huge operation here, and we felt that we'd be able to find qualified workforce here, and initially we did. But the level of our technology has grown more and more complex and sophisticated, and it becomes more challenging to find the right hires right here in our backyard. Our technology has advanced, and our technicians, which used to be maybe straight out of high school, now require a 2 to 4 year college degree. And the vast majority of our engineers that we've hired over the last 3 years have a graduate degree. In fact, we've hired more than 4 times the number of PhD engineers at Intel in Oregon than we have engineers with a bachelor's degree. So it's very, very challenging. And those PhD engineers, sadly, only 2.5% of them came from an Oregon university. And we saw the numbers from ETIC just last year. It was a nice spike in the number of PhDs that Oregon universities graduated, but it was still only 78, and we hire hundreds. So there just isn't the right level of education attainment for the level of sophistication that we're looking for in our hires. We've heard about Asia and the numbers of students that they're graduating, tens of thousands of PhDs, and Oregon, frankly, struggles to get Oregon students to think about a bachelor's level in STEM. So there is a disconnect and a gap, and we're very excited with LC251 and the goals that it has to try and fill that gap. I do want to offer that there's very great bright spots in Oregon's education system. We've heard about FIRST. We've heard about the Oregon Robotics Tournament and Outreach Program. Intel's engaged in those very much. We sponsor qualifying tournaments for the FIRST LEGO Challenge, and we're the state sponsor for the FIRST LEGO League tournament that brings all the top 25% of the students to Hillsboro. So there's some really great things that are happening there. And then we've also recently formed a new partnership with Portland State University on the creation of the Portland Metro STEM Partnership. And this is a prototype of a collective impact partnership that transforms K-12 STEM learning in targeted schools. It engages a cross-section of school districts, of universities, businesses, community partners, government agencies to design, develop, implement, and evaluate strategic plans to transform the STEM learning and teaching cultures here in our schools. And the overarching goal is an alignment and intentional investments. And I think that this is a great example. Bill's going to talk a little bit more about it, but it's a great example of how you take a lot of different activities that are occurring and you put them together in a very targeted, very strategic plan. And that is what's missing right now in Oregon. We have great programs. People are doing Herculean efforts trying to get STEM more advanced in our schools, get more students engaged, but there are a lot of siloed efforts. And so the STEM partnership that you'll hear Bill speak of is doing it in a more systemic way, and we think that LC 251 will take it to the next level. I do want to say that Intel employs 16,000 employees in the state of Oregon, and in less than a year, we will be opening our newest fab, D1X. It's actually ready to be completed by 2013 and be actually fully ramped by that point at the beginning. But we really, really need to fill this gap so that we can have more of our local hires come from graduates of the Oregon University, particularly graduates who are raised in a K-12 Oregon school. And so I applaud the efforts of LC 251. We're ready to roll up our sleeves and be a partner. And if there's anything at all that we can do to give more of these high-paying jobs to Oregon students, we're right there with you.
Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you. Representative Demro, Representative Johnson, committee, thank you for the invitation. My name is Bill Becker. I'm the director of the Center for Science Education at Portland State University. I am a first-generation college graduate. I have earned my doctorate degree in chemistry at Boston University in 1982. Makes me an old man, I know that. I must say, since my arrival at PSU in 1983, we've been engaged in developing and implementing partnerships. We know partnerships well at Portland State University. I know you've heard testimony from my colleagues to talk about how PSU is engaged in the community around us. And our STEM education partnership has been long and growing and has now gotten to a point of being able to be scalable across our region and potentially across the state to be able to impact student learning and achievement for all students at all grade levels in all schools. And I want to talk to you about a collective impact partnership model, which we've designed. We've written a business plan for, and we are now implementing in the Portland metropolitan area. That business plan and that implementation model has also been picked up by other states and other regions of our country as a potential model for doing systemic change in their education systems as well. I know I don't have to, you know, roll the numbers out for you. Our students in Oregon are not making the grade when it comes to achievement in STEM. Our NAEP scores are below average across the board in math and science. We've spent decades trying to move those dials or move those scores. They've been incrementally moved, but if you're talking about whether or not we're going to be able to create the workforce that Intel and others in our region need, the answer right now is unequivocally no. We don't have the capacity to do that. Legislative Concept 251 envisions the establishment of a task force for encouraging students to enroll in STEM programs in our schools. While I believe that's a laudable goal and really a good opportunity, what we are doing is putting students into schools that have a leaky pipeline towards success. Students are not successfully matriculating through our school system onto careers in higher education and beyond in the STEM fields at the numbers that we're going to have in order for our economy to continue to grow. I believe, and my colleagues believe, that sustained growth in our economy will require us to do a transformational change in the way that we teach and learn STEM in our state. My colleagues and I recently have established what we call a collective impact partnership. It includes school districts from the Portland metropolitan area, as well as business and industry partners and higher education. Our partnerships include Beaverton, Hillsborough, Portland, Forest Grove, and Park Grove school districts. We have been joined by faculty from Portland State University, Oregon Health Sciences University, Portland Community College, and our business partners include Intel, Veneer Software Technology, JP Morgan Chase, McKinstry, and Solar World. A little bit about a collective impact partnership. They operate on the basic premise that if you were going to bring about sustained social change, you have to work collectively across a broad spectrum of stakeholders. Our stakeholders commit to a basic set of premises. The principal premise being is that we have to work on a common agenda. We have to also align our efforts on our activities. We have to have a shared measure of success. We have to have open communication across our group, and we have to be able to work through a backbone system that supports the network and the partnership that we're looking at. Our partnership also has three basic assertions, basically our theory of action. And the first is that students will achieve more when they are held accountable for their achievement from clearly articulated learning outcomes that are contextualized to the world beyond. Our second assertion is that strategic partnerships that focus on transformational change for whole school learning communities, and we'll return to this notion in a bit, are effective in bringing about sustainable and measurable change in student achievement. And finally, the third assertion is that a regional STEM partnership needs to have a STEM center, in our case, the STEM Center for College and Career Readiness, that will align the efforts of our partners so that we can bring programming like FIRST and like the Northwest Science Expo and like many of the other programs out there into alignment with the needs and opportunities that are available within the everyday school system for all students. We work with both teachers and community members to design this customized work, and we have researchers at the university beginning the process of generating tools for assessment to measure the effectiveness of these programs so that we will have data to help improve these programs, essentially to continue to help students and teachers improve themselves at being, improve the process of being better. That's a little bit about the background. I'll give you some details about how our partnership operates. We have basic tenets that I've talked to you about before. We also want to talk a little bit about how this rolls out within the districts that we work. A key arbitrator, if you will, or a key member of our partnership team is what we call teachers on special assignment. There is a teacher on special assignment in the room, I believe, Chris Steiner, who's the father of Mary Steiner, who you've just heard about, is the Hillsborough teacher on special assignment. Currently, Portland State University employs 9 teachers on special assignment as a cost-shared position with the school districts that we partner with. These teachers have the opportunity and responsibility to basically work across the high school and across the K-12 higher education system to help us identify ways in which we can help support teachers and students in schools to make transformational change in their community. Our theory of change includes the implementation of a strategic investment model for each of the schools that we work in. We've in the process of identifying the first 8 schools that we will be working in 5 districts. Our business partners help invest the development of strategic investment plans. Those plans are designed for whole school systemic change. We're not importing a one-size-fits-all model. We're basically doing an assets-based approach where we ask our partners and our community members to identify those opportunities and those community assets that can be aligned and can be strengthened in order to bring about systemic change in schools. Our business partners also will then work with us to develop a fund. We would like to see a private-public partnership used to develop these funds. Mm-hmm. These would be funds that would be used to bring about the transformational change in the schools to, again, change the teaching and learning culture. The biggest challenge that we have with our students at this point is the students who drop out of the system do not acquire the identity of a successful STEM learner. It happens throughout the system, but it happens particularly in the middle school and high school grade levels, where students frankly get to 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, and they own the identity of not being successful in STEM. I'm just not good at math, or I'm not good at science, and I can't pursue those careers, and they opt out, sometimes intentionally and sometimes by virtue of how they're counseled, into pathways that basically make them ineligible for higher education careers, higher education and careers in STEM. And we have lots of statistics that I'm going to be happy to bring to you about the leaky pipeline as it relates to students who leave the system because they can't compete. They don't have the competition. They don't have the capability and the skills necessary to be successful, certainly on our campus and many other campuses. In summary, I'm offering testimony to support LC 251. I ask you, however, to revise LC 251 to consider the mission of the STEM Task Force to establish a statewide collective impact partnership. Across our state, there are many communities who come to us to talk about our model and are envisioning opportunities in their own regions. Our State Board of Higher Education, the Provost of my university, and I will be going out to each of the university system schools to talk about the opportunities available in their community to basically replicate versions of our model. But what we really need is a statewide initiative that could be run through the through the STEM Task Force. We know that other states in our region are very actively involved in this. Oregon has been invited to participate as part of a multi-state network. I have been representing our state sort of ad hoc at those committee meetings. There's 11 states: Washington, Oregon, Idaho. California are the West Coast states represented. Other states include Texas, New Mexico, Tennessee, North Carolina, New Mexico, and I'm certain I'm leaving out a few here. Those states are banding together, frankly, as we speak, to develop a national network of state initiatives. We're a little bit behind the game because we don't have a statewide initiative in STEM. Massachusetts has probably the industry standard, if you will, for state partnerships. They've received the Oregon or the National Governors Association sanction as a model program for statewide initiatives. I believe that could be a template for the kind of initiative that we should have in our state. I'd like to entertain questions from the committee at this point. I have more prepared documents. I'm sensitive of the time and we'll give you an opportunity to ask questions. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Bill. And I really appreciate your testimony. I also appreciate your sensitivity to the time because we're running a little late. Unless anyone has any burning questions, you do? Okay, burn away, Rep. Friendly.
You talked about transcendental change or something. Transformational change. I'm intrigued with the partnership you have with OHSU and PSU in this area and in several other kinds of areas. It strikes me, of course, that one of the barriers to doing that as the next department chair at Oregon Health Sciences is the barrier between the governance of two institutions the way they are now, two engineering schools, each with their own deans, two science faculties at different levels across the two. I've had a proposal to bring PSU out of the state system and expand the OHSU board and put the two universities under a single board so that they really could collaborate in a very different way. Well, how does that sound to you as
transformational change?
Transformational change.
I represented Greenlick. I'm aware of your interest in this area. I might add that the conversations that initiated the partnership with OHSU came about because the provost and the interim provost at our sister institution, OHSU, convened a meeting to start to develop ways in which our institutions could, in fact, work more collaboratively together. One of the things I would like to point out is that, our partnership is effective because we work across institutional boundaries and institutional barriers. Our partnership includes private and public, funding and private and public schools and investments. The goal for our partnership and the reason that I think that it's effective is because we don't have the overburden, if you would, of the bureaucracy of each of the institutions. We're creating a shared space that all of us are common and equal partners with the particular outcomes and goals that we have agreed to as part of our partnership. So we're really focused on the end game more than we are on the structure, and we will change the structure in order for it to be effective in supporting what we're trying to accomplish. And I'm afraid if I just sort of dashed around your question a little bit, but that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Just a quick comment, and Bill, you've touched on so many topics. I'd love to connect with you personally and go over a lot of this stuff.
I would be happy to
but
make time.
For one, the concept of a TOSA cost-sharing arrangement with your school district is fascinating to me. I'd really love to investigate that and see what we can do to really funnel some resources in there, because that's a fascinating concept. I think it's a great one. But the other thing that, you know, obviously we get kids excited with STEM. We get them excited with robotics. We put them into the classroom, and we got to make sure that that classroom instructor has the tools necessary to take them instructionally to the next level as well. I'd love to see this state invest in scholarships to ensure that those STEM teachers are able to get the training that they need to have so that they can take the kids to the next level and hopefully plug some of those leaks in that pipeline you referred to. But secondly, the facilities that we have available to teach STEM in at the local level can vary tremendously. We're fortunate in our school district to have the opportunity to build out a bond levy about 3 years ago, where we put in six brand new state-of-the-art science classrooms in our high school that were the same classrooms that I used as a student a few years back. And I can't, you know, the teachers can't get over what a difference it makes on the quality instruction they can provide students in STEM topics in a brand new, you know, lot. So again, as we talk about capital construction projects, I would love to dream about this state creating a capital construction project that could be specifically receive RFPs from local districts about what we want to do to invest in upgrading specifically our science, technology, and mathematics facilities at the local level. That's an exciting prospect for me, so I don't really need to have a response, but you've got me.
Well, I'd like to, Representative Johnson, thank you for those comments. And our TOSA position and our TOSA relationship, we believe, is scalable, and it's the entry point for the partnership with our school districts. The partnerships really rely on a shared and cost-shared and a position-shared sense of purpose. Everybody's got to have skin in the game.
Yep.
I also want to make a little bit of comment on the, you know, on the capital construction and the needs for this.
Actually, Bill, I think we're going to have to move on.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate that. And that will, I'm sure, be one of the topics of the task force roundtable once it's put together. Okay. We're going to be looking at amendments to this bill. One of the things we want to look at is who is part of the roundtable. We want to make sure that the right people are at the table. Right now, it's probably an overly small table. We want to make it bigger. We don't want to make it too huge. But any advice that any of you could give us as to who should be represented, we'd really appreciate that. Well, thank you very much for coming. With that, I'm going to close this public hearing on LC 251. And I am going to open a public hearing on LC 261. Victoria, could you tell us about this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 261 relating to higher education employees. Current statutes require public institutions of higher education to report annually the number of full-time and part-time faculty employed at each institution and its relation to full-time and part-time enrollment. This measure expands that requirement to all employee groups, including at a minimum categories for administrative or management employees, classified or professional, non-faculty employees, and faculty employees.
Great. Thank you. We don't have an invited panel for this subject. We do have one person who has signed up to give public testimony. That's Mark Neusenfeld, if you want to come up. While you're doing that, just to expand on what Victoria has said, you know, currently we get a report each year on the number of full-time faculty and part-time faculty at our state's community colleges and universities. There are, you know, a lot of questions out there about the other employee groups. You know, how about the, you know, the number of classified staff, the number of non-teaching academic professionals, the number of managers. And so this bill will, you know, is designed to expand that report to include all employee groups so that we could have transparency and clarity with agreed upon numbers across our higher ed system. Mark, would you like to?
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs and committee, for having me. My name is Mark Neisenfeld, and I'd like to address the legislative concept 261. Again, my name is Mark Neisenfeld. I'm a member of Service Employees International Union, Local 503, but my purple shirt and tie probably gave me away on that anyway. I'm on the board of directors at the 503, as well as I chair our Higher Ed Council. I chair our bargaining team, and I'm president of the PSU Local. For my day job, I work at Portland State University as a development engineer, where I design and build the custom apparatus for research scientists and graduate students. I've been at PSU for 19 years, and I really love having the opportunity to work with and contribute to the higher education of Oregonians and to the research that advances our knowledge in many areas. However, we at SEIU have some concerns about the direction at our campuses. A 2010 study by the Goldwater Institute entitled Administrative Bloat at American Universities indicated that from 1993 to 2007, the ratio of administrators to students increased markedly at the University of Oregon and Oregon State University. Furthermore, OUS increased spending on the compensation of administrators last year while cutting spending on compensation to other employees. House Bill 2020, passed in the 2010 legislative session, requires state agencies to improve their staffing ratios or span of control of administrators to frontline workers. However, HB 2020 does not apply to higher ed and to OUS, and it probably shouldn't. We believe that higher education operates differently than ODOT and Oregon Parks. But with increasing enrollments, we know we need more frontline staff and faculty working on our campuses. Unfortunately, this is not what's happening, and we believe that the legislature needs to examine why. Fiscal year 2010 staffing and compensation data posted to the Oregon Transparency website divides all OUS employees into three categories: faculty, classified, and administrative. This data indicates that the ratio of full-time faculty and classified staff to administrative staff was a very low 2.7 to 1. Comparable data for 2011 provided in response to a public records request suggests that this ratio did not change. However, this data does show that spending on base salaries for administrative staff increased 3.4% from 2010 to 2011. In comparison, spending on base salaries for faculty increased only 1.5%, and the total base salaries paid to classified staff declined by 0.6%. In 2010, the average base salary for administrators was 89.6% higher than the average salary paid to classified staff. In 2011, this difference increased slightly to 90.2%. In sum, the data presented on the Transparency website clearly indicates a large number of administrative staff. Together with more recent data, all things indicate that OUS has prioritized the compensation of administrative staff over that of other paid employees. We feel that Legislative Concept 261 starts a process to take a good look at staffing levels by establishing baselines, conducting annual reviews of each public institution of higher education with respect to employment. I want to point out that in our current SEIU collective bargaining agreement with OUS, a letter of agreement on our Article 52 sets up a Management Labor Advisory Committee on classification specifications. As a matter of fact, the committee is meeting tomorrow and will be hiring a consultant who will perform a review of the current classification and compensation system and will suggest alternative structures. We will gladly provide your committee with our findings. NFAS would be interested in serving on whatever task force you establish. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee today, and we look forward to working with you in the upcoming legislative session.
Thank you, Mark. Rep. Sheehan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm just as tall as him. Colleagues, I think this is very timely. I just want to point out, and I'll send this link around to you, but I just read an article 2 days ago. It's dated January 8th in the Deseret News titled College Costs Skyrocketing Since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it nails exactly, they talk about specific cost factors and it talks about specifically inefficiencies, but specifically administration. And it says, perhaps the biggest culprit for rising tuition costs is the proliferation of university administrators. And one thing, as it says, is as universities become more reliant on government funding, more administrators are required to deal with that bureaucracy. And then one other thing that struck me was from 93 to 2007, the exact date that you talked about, the number of full-time administrators per 100 students at America's leading public universities grew by 39%. By contrast, the number of employees engaged in teaching increased only by 18%. Mm. So, and then the last thing I'd like to point out is Arizona State University is particularly dramatic. It says during that period, it increased the number of administrators per 100 students by 94%, while reducing the number of employees engaged in instruction, research, and student services by 2%. And anyway, they calculate that 40 million to 55 million in just one school by simplifying the organizational structure could be saved by doing that. So very timely, very good. I applaud that. And I'll send this around as well, but that's huge. And I think it just highlights LC 261.
Thank you, Rick.
Coach, could I just make one point to punctuate?
Sure. Go ahead, Mark.
When I started in 1992 at Portland State, there were six people in the instrument shop, but myself, there were three mechanical guys and two electronics guys, plus a supervisor. Right now we have myself in mechanical, and we have one electronics guy, and Portland State has quadrupled in size since I got there. That's how bad it is.
You don't look that bad, though, Mark, really.
Thank you. My purple shirt.
Thank you, Mr. Cochair. And Mr. Cochair, as we think about potential amendments to these bills, and this bill in particular, right now we're asking for data and information regarding our public institutions of higher ed. I would suggest that we expand that to include the OUS governance system as well as and our community college system too, so that we're not only look at the institutions but the governing entities of those institutions as well too. We can have a full-on look at exactly what's going on from our personnel perspective.
So suggesting the number of employees in the agencies?
Exactly.
Other comments? Thanks, Mark. Thanks for coming up. Okay, with that, then, I will close the public hearing on LC 261. And I'm going to open public hearing on LC 288. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 288 relating to higher education governance. This measure establishes a task force on higher education governance and coordination to review, discuss, and analyze issues of governance within the higher education system and coordination among elements of that system with other education programs and missions. The task force will report its findings and recommendations to the Governor and the Legislative Assembly no later than November 1st, 2012.
Thank you. Just as a bit of background, you know, those of you who have been following this committee know that we have been talking about returning to the process that was begun last session, where we had a legislative work group made up of, that was bicameral, half from the House, half from the Senate, to look at higher education governance, and that's what led us to Senate Bill 242. It was a very successful process that resulted in that very important bill that ended up moving OUS away from state agency status to moving into being a public university system. And we have been talking about reconvening that task force, not necessarily with the same members, but in fact with 4 members from the House, 4 from the Senate, and 2 from the Governor's Investment Board, the Oregon Education Investment Board, to do a sort of round 2. And this one would really focus on the question of local boards, institutional boards, and to recommend legislation to create a path for local boards or a system of local boards. And that's where this bill had its genesis. In the meantime, from the last time that we talked about it, of course, some dramatic things happened in the state, which I think put more urgency, perhaps, to this issue, and is related to the University of Oregon president and the decision to non-renew. I think that makes the need for us to address this issue promptly that much more important. And that's why we're going to be bringing this bill before you. There are others who have other models that they would like us to consider. There are two pieces, there are two LCs out there. One drafted by Representative Barnhart, one drafted by Representative Beyer. And we'd like to give them an opportunity to present their concepts to us, and then we have a panel of invited guests to also address the legislative concept. So, representatives, if you would come forward. And just for the audience, just to let you know, we have posted both of these LCs on our committee website, so they're there for your perusal. Okay, who wants to start?
I don't mind.
You're both Bs.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. BA.
I'm a little bit ahead in the alphabet. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. If I am reelected, I will have the honor of representing the University of Oregon in the legislature. My boundary line moved from a place where I simply represented the law school to a place where I would end up having the whole campus in my district, minus Autzen Stadium, the football stadium. That's not the reason that I'm here this morning or this afternoon, but it's related to it. I really want to introduce a different legislative concept, which you have on your website, and I'm passing out now a short piece that describes what the point of this is and also gives you a summary of the bill. I'm not actually printing the bill because the bill is 284 pages long, but the bill itself is very simple, and the vast majority of the bill is conforming legislation. The vast majority, about 10 pages of it, actually contains something that's new, and that's pretty easy to deal with. This comes up. This bill, by the way, addresses the issue of independent boards for the University of Oregon and Portland State University. I purposely did not deal with the other universities because I haven't had any indication that any of the others were interested, at this time at least, in independent boards. Under my bill, they would remain under the governance of the State Board of Higher Education at least until the study group contemplated in 288 reports and the legislature adopts some change. It came up as a result of the incident that the chair refers to, and which I'll call the La Riviere incident, at which time it became quite clear to us, to many of us, that the existing state structure is iatrogenic to the universities, because it means that the state board is in a position where if it takes a position that protects one university, it may actually cause a deterioration at a different one. And that became quite clear as I reviewed the situation that incident raised. We can argue about whether President LaRiviere acted correctly or not. We cannot argue about whether the board was in a position where it felt that it was stuck to take a policy position that was supportive of one or more institutions and that was detrimental to another. That this change needs to occur. I would agree that, but for the incident, this wouldn't be coming up now. It would be coming up next year. But it's important that it comes up now, because it's important that we have a clear, robust, and inevitable local public board setting for higher education institutions that want them. And the way to get that is to pass a bill this session that gets us there. What this bill does is it sets up separate boards for Portland State and the University of Oregon, boards appointed primarily by the governor, approved by the Senate, boards that also would have representatives of the foundations, the faculty, the classified staff, and the students at these institutions. The boards would appoint a president subject to the confirmation by the OEIB. And essentially, that's it. The bill fits in quite well with Senate Bill 909 and Senate Bill 242. 242 earlier established some additional independence for the State Board of Higher Education. This simply transfers that independent function from the State Board to the local boards. So much of the work of this bill was actually done last time, and I had nothing to do with that except I think I voted for it. I want to note that this bill is not related to the distribution of state funds. We left that completely out of this bill, except for the way in which the budget actually reaches the legislature. That's an easy change. If the committee wanted to do it a different way, it could easily be changed so that coordinating function either continued to the State Board of Higher Education for the time being or went to the OEIB. In any event, that issue is moot for this biennium because the budget's already been adopted, and it was certainly not my intent to attempt to change the distribution of state funds in a way that would advantage any university. That is not the function of the bill. Currently, the University of Oregon receives less than 6% of its budget from the state through the regular budget process. I don't anticipate that that's going to change in any significant way, and we're not attempting to raise the funds available for that institution. I think the decisions concerning the small universities and the other large university need to be done. That certainly can wait until 13, until the report of the work group proposed in 288. I don't see any conflict with the legislation, with the legislative or the governor's plans in connection with the educational coordination plan, because in this bill we include the coordination requirements that I think have been well identified. Degree authorization, tuition changes, and a few other things that are easily discerned. I see this bill as important today because it will allow for a clear path for the University of Oregon to achieve an independent board. Independent board under this bill would be established on July 1. It would take charge of the university on July 1 of 13. During that year, it would get itself organized, get ready to do its work, and be prepared to hit the ground running as an independent and coordinated board. I will note that before July 1, there will be another legislative session. If, as they are setting up, it appears that there are problems, those can be addressed in an additional bill that will certainly come up around university governance. Why is it important now? The university is in need of a president. And with the best chance we have of hiring the kind of president with the qualifications that we want is for that person to understand that the chances of operating in a way that benefits the students of the state of Oregon and allows the universities to function in accordance with their strengths and their capacities is maximized. And I think allowing an independent board is the way to get there. Are there alternatives? Absolutely. But any alternative that would be acceptable would have to include a certain, robust, and inevitable local public board for the higher education institutions that want them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Rep. Barnhart. Representative Beyer?
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. I'm Representative Terry Beyer, and thank you for allowing me to be here to present my bill. My bill has some very big similarities to Representative Barnhart's bill, but as you can see, it's a little more blunt instrument. And it also, it's not quite as long as Representative Barnhart's bill, but it is long, but again, most of it is conforming language. Most of the bill is in the first 11 pages of the bill, so, and the summary is very descriptive of what's in the bill, and which is to abolish the State Board of Higher Education and transfer those functions to the Oregon Education Investment Board. Abolishes the position of chancellor of the Oregon University System and transfers those functions to the chief education officer. And it repeals a sunset provision relating to the Oregon Education Investment Board and chief education officer. Requires Senate confirmation for chief education officer. Authorizes governor to appoint presidents of public universities subject to confirmation by Senate and establishes process for authorizing local university governing boards. Plus the conforming languages. There is another piece in there that does address the compacts that would the compact would be with individual universities or an individual university that chooses to select a board. So it's pretty basic, and I'm not gonna kid you. It does come out of some frustration with the higher ed board. I will say that. But another thing is with the legislation that was passed last year, 909. The 242, I think we have a lot of duplication right now that we have to work our way through. And in my mind, this maybe helps push us to that next step. There are an awful lot of boards. We have the, I don't even have to, you guys did all this work, so I don't have to address those, but there are a lot of boards, and at some point we have to figure out if we really are trying to create a cohesive system and a more streamlined system, then we need to move forward on making some of these choices now. And I'll go ahead and stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. Representative Lindsay.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, just a statement, the frustration, I felt the frustration as well. Regardless of where you came down on what happened last December, the thing that I found very, very, that was handled poorly was that some of the people that came and testified to us came just 2 days before that announcement happened, and knowing full well what was going to happen, they came and testified right before us, and now today, nowhere to be seen. I think that was just poorly handled. That's number one. Number two, I have a great book here called The Innovative University. I recommend that everybody reads this, and I'm going to explain why. The author is Clayton Christensen of Harvard, and He's the author that also wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, that talks about private enterprise and how entities, lots of entities, are born and then they die. If they don't innovate, they die. Mm-hmm. And he puts that model on the university system and explains that what happens is you got a lot of upstarts, community colleges, universities, but there's no exits. It's a different model. But he puts that on there and gives ideas of how other universities are innovating in the system that we have where there are no exits. And I think that this bill that you've outlined is an innovative approach. We might not all agree on it, but at least it's kicking the anthill, at least it's bringing innovation, it's bringing ideas, and that's what needs to happen. If we don't do it, there's going to be terrible destruction, but it's not innovative destruction, it's just, not doing anything destruction.
Right.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, representatives.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have a panel now of, let's see, you know who you are, come on up.
Ken, Paul.
Sorry. Yeah, Bob Davies, Ben Eckstein, and Paul Weinhold, please. And while they're getting themselves set, you know, I think we all agree, Rep. Lindsay, that change needs to happen. And, you know, the question is, how do we make sure that it's the right change and that the process of getting to change makes it positive change, you know, makes sure that we're not just creating things that next year we're going to take apart again, that is, entered into with a lot of deliberation and frankly, in a very public, transparent manner. And that I think is the primary motivation behind this notion of a legislative work group, which would be doing its work out in the the spotlight of the the public eye, and receive testimony from all the stakeholders. So, who wants to start?
Let's go with Baldwin. Thanks, good
name. Okay. All right. I'll be happy to start.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, and members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to provide this, what will be a very brief testimony on behalf of the University of Oregon. And for the record, I'm Paul Weinhold, President and CEO of the University of Oregon Foundation. We appreciate what you are doing and your counterparts are doing with the Senate and the Governor to continue to make the post-secondary education a priority in Oregon this year. Recognize that the progress made in 2011 was not an end, but the beginning of reforming and improving Oregon's system of higher education. To that end, I'm here to urge you to use this opportunity, the first annual session, to continue making progress and to take the next steps in management reform and accountability that are essential to delivering Oregonians access to world-class public education. We believe that your accomplishments in 2011 positioned the state to make continued and meaningful progress during the February session around several key goals and objectives, including access and affordability for Oregon students who want to attend an Oregon public university, a path certain to greater operational autonomy, which will lead to greater efficiency, innovation, transparency, and accountability for the public institutions that want them, a state structure that fosters collaboration between the seven universities and leaders in Salem with recognition of the unique student bodies at each institution, greater ability for our universities to leverage public and private resources to maximize strategic investment at our respective institutions. And let me be clear, these are not steps that serve just the University of Oregon. They serve all of Oregon. Mm-hmm. They serve Oregon's collective future, the quality of our economy, our social fabric, and our educational system at every level. And we are not asking for independence. We are asking for a certain path toward academic excellence and the freedom to achieve the same kind of operational efficiencies that institutions like ours around the country have. And we're here today with a commitment to you, the Senate leadership, the governor, and partners in higher education to work collaboratively to advance this common mission for excellence. Thank you for your time and your continued leadership, and I look forward to working with you and others as we advance on this path. Thank you.
Hello, Co-Chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the House Committee on Higher Education. Thank you for inviting me here today to testify in regard to Legislative Concept 288, and I'm on two more panels, so I hope you're not sick of me by the end of the day. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the students of the University of Oregon in strong support of this legislative concept. I am also serving in my second year on the Board of Directors of the Oregon Student Association and on the HB 3418 Task Force for Student and Institutional Success. I also served from 2010 to 2011 on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, now the Oregon Student Access Commission. The past year has seen major reforms to our system of statewide public higher education. Senate Bill 242, Senate Bill 909, and several other critical pieces of legislation pertaining to higher education have recently taken or will shortly take effect and redefine the way that our state views higher education. Amid these changes, a statewide conversation on the concept of institutional boards has continued unabated but without any clear resolution. From my perspective as a student leader at the University of Oregon, on this issue, there are infinitely more questions than answers. For students, many of these questions highlight the conflict between a coordinated statewide vision for public education embodied in legislation like Senate Bill 242 and 909, and a push for deregulation and disconnection embodied in legislation such as Senate Bill 559, the UO New Partnership Proposal. Students have questions like, how can we achieve 40-40-20 without a robust statewide system that coordinates our public institutions of higher education? We have asked, how can we protect access and affordability without maintaining our strong legislative oversight of tuition setting? And more recently, in light of the University of Oregon's recent pursuit of a $100 million student building project without student support, how can we protect student voice in capital projects if we leave bonding decisions to an institutional board with strong ties to institutional fundraising efforts? As student body president, I personally saw the benefits of statewide regulation impact affordability on my campus when students were collectively able to prevent the approval of a $100 per term new student fee because the State Board of Higher Education was unwilling to approve the fee without student support through a referendum. Students on my campus will pay less next year because we have a strong statewide system that put the needs of Oregon students above the interests of any one particular institution. During the coming legislative session, the students I represent fear the prospects of skyrocketing tuition and painful cuts to need-based financial aid. At the same time, we find ourselves fighting to keep our education public and to maintain the systems of accountability that have been among our few protections as students, preventing double-digit tuition increases and unilateral fee increases. While the proposition of achievement compacts holds much potential, achievement compacts represent a system of goals but not a system of accountability. Reducing accountability at a time when we need it more than ever to educate Oregon students would hit my constituents even harder. Though the issue of institutional boards may not seem new to us, the truth is that we have only begun our exploration of many potential consequences and risks of establishing institutional boards. To act on this issue during a 25-day legislative session while simultaneously doing everything we can to meet our basic educational needs for the remainder of the biennium would be a gamble that students cannot afford. As we speak, the state of Texas is in the process of re-regulating its statewide system of higher education after a successful push by some Texas universities for more autonomy. At the same time, the state of Florida continues its legal struggles over the division of power between the state, the system, and the campuses in the wake of its own deregulation. I support LC 288 because it would further explore higher education reforms, such as the issue of institutional boards, while allowing for a prudent opportunity to extensively study the effects of further changes. At a time when students are responsible for two-thirds of the cost of our education, LC 288 is about allowing an opportunity for students and other stakeholders to be heard. While the University of Oregon points to a lower level of state investment as justification for its proposed deregulation, I would remind the committee that decreases in state support have been compensated for with my constituents' tuition dollars. A disinvestment by the state, therefore, is not cause for greater autonomy for the University of Oregon, but rather a cause for stronger consideration of the interests and needs of University of Oregon students who provide more than 50% of the university's revenue. LC 288 is in the best interest of students. It is a chance for us to step back, evaluate recent reforms, and determine how best we can move forward together to achieve 40-40-20 and to ensure the right of all Oregonians to a quality, affordable, accessible post-secondary education. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ben. Dr. Davies.
My name is Bob Davies, the president of East Oregon University, and thank you for inviting me to give my thoughts regarding this very important issue of governance structures for our public universities in Oregon. Before I begin my formal comments, I would like to provide a very brief biography of my own history and my experiences So that will provide you a background and give you some guiding lights from my perspectives as it comes to governance. I received my PhD in higher education administration, where I specifically targeted my research towards presidential leadership, towards governance, to the use of systems and other mechanisms in public higher education. I also must say that this followed my studies at the University of Oregon, where I earned my MBA, and so I am three ducks in a line here. to not engage anyone else, I will say that I did send my niece to Oregon State University, so we are also a platypus household. As many of you know, I have served as president of Eastern Oregon University since July 1 of 2009. And since that time, you have witnessed the many positive changes we have made at our university and the significant challenges that we have overcome. The book that Representative Lindsay held up has been our blueprint and continues to be our blueprint, because we must innovate, we must change. And if you read that book and substitute Southern New Hampshire University for Eastern Oregon University, you will see amazing similarities. I have now served at five separate public universities. These universities range from an AAU research Carnegie One university that has a top-tier medical school, pharmacy school, dental school, and law school, the only one in the nation with that category, a land-grant university, a metropolitan university, a doctoral granting state university, and now a regional university. At these universities, I have dealt with boards of higher education that were publicly elected and oversaw a chancellor system that contained all public universities and community colleges, a politically appointed board that so oversaw the entire educational enterprise from kindergarten to PhDs. I also served in the largest state system in the United States that was governed by institutional-specific boards and had a statewide coordinating board. I also served at a state that had two parallel organizations. One was a system of institutional-specific boards reporting to a chancellor, running right along the side of a system in which public universities had their own board, states of their own institutional-specific boards without a tie to a system. And then obviously here in the system of Oregon. Each of these structures have their advantages. Each one has their disadvantages. Some worked much better than others. Some benefited universities at others based on political approaches, the role of alumni and supporters, and even geographic reach. From my experiences at these five universities, under these five different types of systems, as well as my studies and earning my PhD, I have developed a great sense of understanding of the nuances that you face as legislators and the nuances that form a topic. Therefore, let me state from the outset that I am not necessarily opposed to public universities having institutional-specific boards. There are cases in which this has proven to be effective, and those involved would provide statements to that fact. There are others, obviously, who would disagree and make similar claims that institutional-specific boards harm the public mission. I could talk specifically about the four different universities and the systems I've worked in. But let me talk a little bit about my experience here at Oregon and Eastern Oregon University. And I also have to say that this topic led me right back to my studies at the University of Oregon, where in the many courses dealing with organization and strategic decisions, we discussed the structures of those organizations, of those institutions, and how they had a specific impact on all the aspects of that organization, from decision-making, to hiring, to evaluations, to seeking people to fill those leadership positions, to meeting the goals of the organization itself, and sometimes the goals of the owners, which sometimes countered that of the organization. These same discussions fueled my insights and my thoughts about the topic of governance here at Eastern Oregon University, as well as my studies. My belief is that the structure, the governance, and the organization must follow the strategy, which must follow the organizational goals, which must follow the desired outcomes. We must focus in on what we are trying to achieve first and foremost, then set the goals of that organization, then set the structure. In my own leadership at Eastern, when this issue of institutional boards was first raised, I will freely admit I was very compelled by the idea of pursuing a board for Eastern. I envied the idea that I would be able to work directly with 10 to 15 individuals specifically on issues we faced, to seek their advice and wisdom, not to grapple with six other presidents who, by the way, love to talk and hear themselves talk, for their attention. I felt empowered by the idea of taking this board to the legislative body to lobby each one of you on EOU's causes, for funding, for projects, and for other ideas. But then I sat back, and then I began to analyze this further, and some very important discussions we needed to take place for that board to be successful. How and who will ultimately decide tuition? How will the student voice be heard in that discussion? How and who will evaluate the performance of our institution, and how will it be analyzed? How will our goals of access, affordability, and engagement be judged, and by who? The board? Another state board, as mentioned previously? A lot of state boards have been created. Our legislators. And what would happen when those boards and those entities and those bodies came into conflict? How would I balance the need to preserve our access mission when our own board may want higher tuition increases to meet other needs? Or not to seek tuition increases at the financial detriment of our institution? How would I balance the pulls of major donors to our institution that now sit on the governing board and judge where our university will go? How do I serve that statewide mission of EOU? And EOU has a statewide mission, as we have sites and centers in each of your districts where we are serving students in your districts with a localized board that would have localized issues, localized concerns, and they may lose that statewide approach. And a very important consideration, by implementing these institutional boards, how do we as presidents continue, or in some cases start, to collaborate with other universities in meaningful and productive ways to serve our state? Let me elaborate on that a little bit. Higher education is a competitive field. We are always competing for something, for funding, for donors, for students. I was very disappointed to see the student today who did the first program is going to Oregon State and not Eastern. I will have to say that 33 of the first LEGO students have full-ride scholarships at Eastern Oregon University. So I need to put that plug out there. But we are always competing for airtime, for prestige. And this does not even include the athletic programs that we put on the field. And let me also say that competition is a good thing. It makes us better. It makes us more sharp. It makes us perform better. And presidents, by our nature, are very competitive individuals, and we get off on the rush of competition. But to meet the needs of the state, we must cease to compete in certain areas and at certain times and find ways to collaborate, aggressively seek ways to collaborate and to make joint programs. We do that now to a certain degree. For example, did you know that the largest range management program in the United States is not at Lincoln, Nebraska, is not in Pullman at Washington State, it is in LeGrand. It is a collaboration with Oregon State and Eastern Oregon University where we serve more students studying agriculture and ranch management than any other place in the United States. And that is done because of those collaborations. If we had institutional boards, would those collaborations still exist? Would they still continue to thrive? The role of the system is to encourage our efforts to compete in many ways. We are judged by the system on the number of students, the number of underrepresented students that we serve, the generation of new ideas, just to name a few. But it also provides the forum for these collaborations to exist and to thrive. At a recent meeting with an informal group of several business and civic leaders in LeGrand and throughout Eastern Oregon, we talked about an institutional board for Eastern and the various advantages and disadvantages. In answering that question and furthering the discussion, we reflected on the last several years at Eastern. As you all know, at Eastern we had to make some very difficult and politically charged decisions. We have eliminated programs, we are decreasing funding in many areas, and we took on symbolic issues that have roots going back 5 decades or more. So we discussed, how would a local board made a difference in these decisions and actions? Would it have made it easier? I don't think so. In fact, I think it would have been more politically charged. Would different decisions have been made? May have been. But would they have been the right decisions? I don't think so. Eastern Oregon University is not only the educational center for Eastern Oregon. We are also the cultural, the civic, and the largest employer in the immediate area. We are an economic driver. Would a board assist us in these goals? Ultimately, we asked the question, Would an EOU board help serve the funding issues? Would it help us reach 40-40-20 in our region? Would it help with the implementation of the Eastern Promise, which is a true K-20 collaborative paradigm? Would it help raise more funds? Would it help us recruit more underrepresented students and serve more non-traditional and first-generation college students? As we answer those questions, we don't think it necessarily would. As I stated at the beginning of my presentation, I am not opposed to institutional boards. In fact, if they will lead to the advancement of public higher education throughout our state, if they create an atmosphere of collaboration as well as competition in meeting our goals, if they increase total funding and preserve access for all students, if it will lead to the achievement of our shared goals and objectives, and if they reflect on the desires through the outcomes of consequent and relevant actions of the university, of the citizens of this great state, as they are truly the owners and beneficiaries of our system, we would in fact support an institutional-specific board. Members, we have a great deal of work ahead of us. We have an enormous goal of 40-40-20. We have significant funding issues, and as the system, as Jay Kenton will elaborate later on this afternoon, our investment in public higher education has decreased, and it's on a precipice in many ways. But the return on that investment has been fruitful. Structure and governance is a key issue as we move forward. And in light of the many proposed changes, in light of what we are doing, from achievement compacts to new statewide committees and how these work, this will be an evolving topic. We need, as a state that overtly articulates the need for higher education, a robust and coordinated system of public higher education, as stated earlier, one that invites collaborations, invites competition, and makes us all excel and work together of all seven universities. As such, I firmly believe that we do need to ask the tough question of what should governance be like, and fully research that question. What is the proper governance structure given all of the changes? What will be the end task? We need to ask and answer what is that proper role and where should it lie? In the end, it may be with institutional boards. It very well may be. There may be other ideas to move forward. I think that is why I support Legislative Concept 288 so much, because it must be asking that question of how do we not only become an innovative university, but an innovative system. Thank you very much for your time. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, President Davies, and all three of you. Let me just open it, before I open it up to questions, let me say that you know, you've all probably noticed that in its current form, this LC is very vague. You know, it simply says that the task force will be convened, and it talks about who will be on it. But it says that it will address issues of university governance. And, you know, I think it's been our intention, the two co-chairs' intention all along, to make that charge more specific. Once we had heard feedback from you all on this committee and hearing the testimony from people who come forth. And I think that that probably is kind of in line with what you were talking about, Paul, right? That is that... it seems as if you are, supportive of the process that we're talking about, but want to, would like to see the charge made more specific so that you and others could feel that, you know, we're not just kicking the can down the road. You know, we're not just convening a debating society, a study group, but actually are doing something that's going to lead to something. But would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that's very accurate. And I think that we have another more compelling reason right now is that we have a presidential position to fill, mm-hmm. and having some sort of clarity on this topic is going to be helpful in that process. Not that it's going to be finished, but to know the direction that things are heading, it is important. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
I didn't have anything to say on that.
I agree with Paul. I don't think that kicking the can down the road is the way to go. We have significant charges ahead of us. We have a very, very monumental hill to climb in 40-40-20. We are facing significant issues, and just having a task force to have a debating society, as you said, Chair Dembro, is not the way to go. I think that we need to pay very careful attention, because once you start down this process, and once you start implementing institutional boards, there is no way to go back. So what is the best way, what is the best mechanism, what are the best structures to have in place that would allow for those to move forward? One of the things that I find very compelling about the state system is that there are seven universities with seven different missions, and we do not have a one-size-fits-all. Mm-hmm. To put in place procedures and policies and hold the Eastern Oregon University to the same standards as the University of Oregon would be catastrophic for both of us.
Sure.
Unless you want to...
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, that. Yes. But I think it's very important that we do fully analyze this. There are so many changes going on. As I mentioned, at this point in time, Eastern is not interested in an institutional-specific board. That can change with where these different boards go, with the four or five different boards that have a direct impact into higher education at this particular time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, what we would like from committee members and also from all stakeholders is your suggestions over the next week. We are looking at amendments to this bill to clarify the charge more. We would like to, we're talking about an amendment that would have a mandatory start date for this work group that would begin something like 30 days after the close of session, just so that we can make sure that it can really do its work in a timely manner. So anyway, this is just an open invitation to everyone in the room and everyone out there in the stratosphere to send us your ideas. If they could be sent to our committee administrator, Victoria Cox, we would really appreciate that. Mark, do you?
Yeah, just thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to second your comments, and I think to reassure, I think everyone out there, that I think you and I do have a lot of commonality on the purpose of this task force, and are really working together to bring this to where it needs to go. But just a second that. It needs to be timely. We need to get about our work quickly. This isn't just something to set on the shelf and say we'll get there in a month or, months down the road. We need to get about that, because we're very sensitive to the position that the foundation finds themselves in now. You know, as they're in this search for a president, it's critical that we show some action quickly. But secondly, to provide much more specificity to the objectives that we hope to come from the task force, specifically to address the institutional board question, I think, additionally, questions about perhaps consolidation of governance within the OUS system and so forth as well need to be looked at specifically, and that task force needs to come back to us. But again, it needs to be open, it needs to be transparent, so that there can be confidence in the outcomes. People can understand how this task force gets to wherever it gets to, and so there's confidence in the process, so that those recommendations have credibility throughout this building. So. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Colleagues, if you don't have any questions, specific questions of these witnesses, we do have one person who has signed up to speak, and I'll call her up now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Tiffany Dollar from OSA.
Hello and good afternoon. Thanks for all of you who've stuck it out so far. thanks, Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee for letting me speak to you all today. My name is, as mentioned before, Tiffany Dollar. I am the board chair of the Oregon Student Association, and I'm a member of student government at Portland State University, and I'm here today to talk to you about Legislative Concept 288, or the Higher Education Governance Legislative Task Force bill. The most obvious benefit to students about this is that we see it as a benefit of time. A task force of this nature will address post-secondary education governance and the controversial issue of institutional boards. A 30-day session is not enough time to vet this complicated issue. Mm-hmm. Legislators need to hear from experts. and stakeholders before taking on this controversial topic, and a legislative session of only 30 days is simply not long enough. A secondary benefit that students see is that the Oregon legislature is far more likely to pass laws which are supported by a wide variety of stakeholders. When complicated and controversial concepts which are vetted by the legislative task force. The task force that created SB 242 for the 2011 legislative session created an opportunity for legislative leadership on that bill to hear from experts. Those who would be affected by the bill and the public had an opportunity to testify. We have seen the benefit of legislative task forces in previous legislative sessions, and students would like to put this best practice to work again for Oregonians. The last comment that I would like to make is that students have tried to mirror this due diligence that the legislative task force would create. We have devised a task force of students to develop principles regarding post-secondary education governance. One of our greatest values is support of a unifying governing board to maintain accountability for post-secondary education governance. We want to make sure that post-secondary education remains accessible and affordable to all Oregonians. Furthermore, those in support of giving local boards to PSU and U of O in the February 30-day session say that PSU and U of O receive low funding from the state and therefore they should be able to govern themselves. Like Ben said before, students are the ones paying more than 50% of the total cost to run those institutions, and we are asking to be heard. We are asking for a task force to put in the effort necessary to develop a governance system that will be a benefit for all of the students and all Oregonians. We know that the status quo is not perfect, but we think a task force would help students address some of the overlapping goals with the structures that currently exist and create a system that holds institutions accountable for educating Oregonians and keeping education affordable. This is not a session to be creating more or new governance structures in the post-secondary education system. This is a time to build a task force to address governance structures and decide what is best for the whole of Oregon. Thank you again for your time, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thanks, Tiffany. Any questions for Tiffany? Okay. Thanks, Tiffany. Colleagues, any questions or comments about this LC? Okay, thank you. Then with that, I will close this public hearing on LC 288. And I would like now to open work sessions on all five of the committee bills and have them accepted so that we can bring them to the next session. So I'm going to open a public hearing first on LC, I'm sorry, a work session on LC 251. And I would entertain a motion to for the committee to introduce this LC.
Mr. Chair, I move we introduce LC 251 dated 12/19/11 as a committee bill.
Okay. Rep. Johnson has moved the introduction of this bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to this being introduced? Hearing none. LC 251 will be introduced as a committee bill,
Mr.
as
Chair,
a committee measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we
close the work session on LC 251, and I am now going to open.
Can I read all these in at one time?
If you take the other four, you can open just simultaneously four work sessions and take one motion if you want to.
That's no fun. I don't get to bang the thing as
it's
much.
No, that's fine. Let's get her done.
All right. Being sensitive to the ears of my colleagues in the audience, I'm going to open a work session then on LC 261, LC 288, LC 284 and LC 287.
Did you hit it yet? Mr. Chair, I
yes,
move
Rep.
that
Jones.
We would introduce LC 261 dated 12-8-11, LC 288 dated 12-8-11, LC 284 dated 12-14-11, and LC 287 dated 12-14-11 as committee measures.
Okay, Rep. Johnson has moved to introduce those measures. Let me just say for the record, the two measures that we did not have public hearings on, LC 287 is the one that we heard a discussion of last meeting related to the Western Governors University and credit for prior learning, and also the textbook affordability bill, which we had lengthy discussion of last session, and this committee approved, I think, unanimously last session, and it failed to advance for procedural reasons at the end. So any discussion of these measures? Yes, Rep. Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On LC 284, I joined the committee late and missed some of the discussion. I just wanted to bring to everybody's attention something happened today, actually, that Apple introduced something that they are calling the textbook killer. So the new iBooks, and I've just been sort of looking at this through the committee hearing here, there's McGraw-Hill, looks like they're the first ones out there, and they're high school textbooks right now, but I'm looking at one on Amazon.com that's a printed textbook. It's about 1,900 pages long, and it's $100. They're having it on iBooks right now, same textbook, except there's video and there's some other things. You can highlight, you can write notes to yourself. It will generate note cards at the end. There's some scoring capability, so it's really advanced. And that same textbook is $14.99. So I think it might be a good idea to include that as it goes through the committee to address, in addition to some of the things that the task force is being charged with, to look at some of these new mechanisms.
Yeah, that is, Rep. Sheehan, that's at the heart of what that bill is all about. So, yeah, I appreciate that. I think we're looking at perhaps having a public hearing on that the first week of the session. You know, we'll see as we work on the schedule, but we will have a robust hearing on that, looking at all the different possibilities out there. Okay, so seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to our introducing all four? Seeing no objection, those four measures are introduced. Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on those four bills, and I am going to open an information session now on the HB 3418 Task Force Student and Institutional Success Task Force Report. And we have a presentation from one of the two task force chairs, Ed Dodson, and task force member Ben Eckstein. And just in full candor, I will say that Rep. Johnson and I also both sit on that task force. So the task force, just, you know, as we're getting set up, you might remember, as we were looking at granting more autonomy to OUS, we also needed to have more accountability of OUS in terms of how these public universities and community colleges were contributing to student success and removing obstacles to student success, and finding strategies to reward and incentivize student success. And so with that as a background, let me turn it over to Ed and Ben.
Thank you, Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Johnson and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to share the work that we've done so far on this task force and this bill. I would ask Representative Johnson and Representative Dembro to bat cleanup for us in case we miss some point that you would like to have brought forward more clearly. My name is Ed Dodson. I spent about 32 years with the Salem-Keizer School District. I have been on the Chemeketa Board and currently am on the Chemeketa Board and am this year the chair of the Oregon Community College Association. Ben, would you like to give your...
Yes, it's been a long time. I'm Ben Eckstein, and I'm one of the student representatives on the task force.
I would love to have his energy. Oh, for the energy of youth. The task force charge, there were five charges, and I believe you have a set of slides in front of you that may have those. The first charge that the committee had related to examining best practices and to achieve student and institutional success. A second one was to identify barriers to success. And it's interesting, as we worked through those, they took on the label of rocks, kind of to signify barriers to it. The third was to examine methods to gain basic skills and also professional technical skills, to review alternative funding material or methods, and to look at funding methods of other states. Now, we've attended, for the most part, to those first two. We've examined pretty closely barriers and strategies. We'll be giving attention to funding issues as we work through the rest of the year. We'll have a report later in the year. Task force membership, Ben will share with you.
So here's a roster of the membership of the task force, and you'll notice there are many appointees from the governor and then four legislative appointees. The last two are particularly outstanding, I think. We have also a diversity, I think, of representation from the different stakeholder groups. There are teachers on the task force, administrators. There's a cross-section of students, small and large business community members. And even within those groups, within the students, for example, you'll see representation from different sectors of post-secondary education. So it's a very diverse group in cross-section from different sectors.
We might ask why the work of the task force is of interest to your efforts. And we believe that the recommendations that will come from this task force will help very much with the setting of achievement compacts for higher ed. We believe there's even an indirect link in helping with the high school compacts and achievement goals. And as we move through this, there will be strategies that will require some funding. And so we'll need to look at how we're going to do that. As we began our work, the next slide shows an affinity diagram that we use to show the connections, the relationships that exist between the legislation that you're all considering now and as you bring that forward. As I looked at that, you will notice that those draw us to that need for student success. But as I was preparing for this presentation, I looked up affinity. And I found it interesting because in the definitions, the concepts were kinship, relationship, conformity, connections, linkages. And the last definition was one that had to do with chemistry affinities. And that definition was the attractive force exerted in different degrees between atoms, which cause them to enter into and remain in combination. Now, that's a definition I would like for some of the affinities we work with. And I would hope that our behaviors, our attitudes, our beliefs, and where we're going will provide that attraction and keep us together.
Like Ed said, a lot of the work that we've done so far has been focusing on identifying the most significant barriers affecting student success, and we call them the big rocks, or what they're called in our interim report. And using the perspectives of all the different members of the task force and the different work they do, and in the context of those affinities that Ed talked about, we tried to identify really what is holding us back from 40-40-20, what is preventing student success and institutional success, and what do we need to tackle if we want to reach it. And so that's the list that we came up with in our interim report, and to highlight a few, insufficient funding and a limited ability for students to pay the cost of their education was the first one, and in many ways the most important one that we had identified, because of course if we can't address the issue of students being able to afford their education, then we can't ultimately make help get students to success. We also identified limited support services like advising and tutoring, and how we can work on programs that provide students with more of those services and actually support them in completion of their degree programs once they enter. We had also talked about insufficient support for career and technical education programs, and this was one that I think particularly thinking about 40-40-20 is important when we think about students who go into our community college workforce development programs, making sure that we're focusing on associate degree programs and other programs that aren't necessarily bachelor's. And then finally, we also had identified insufficient support for underrepresented communities, and especially looking at the changing demographics of our state, we thought this was a very important one to make sure that we're helping students to reach success in their education.
It's interesting, as we were working our way through these and discussing them, there was one that I related very clearly with, and that was limited college-going culture in rural areas. I was the first in my family to go to college. I did not think of going to college when I graduated from high school. In fact, I did not go to college for 5 years, and probably would not have gone except that college was very much in the culture of my foreman at U.S. Plywood, where I was working. He was on my back every night to get to college, because I had graduated with his son. And Representative Denbrough and I presented this to the OEIB, and we got some pushback from them saying, wait a minute, that's not just a rural issue. That college culture exists also in cities and in larger areas. So yes, it is rural, but it is also throughout the rest of the state. So I thought that was really, really interesting. The next slide, or then in fact the next two slides, we've identified 40 strategies for dealing with those barriers. And I think about 20 of those are listed on these two pages. Don't need to read them. You'll have the report available to you. And those are areas that we will focus on as we move forward with that. Go ahead, Ben.
And Ben, excuse me if I can just interrupt.
Absolutely.
Let me just make an announcement. It's probably obvious to you all that we're not going to have time to get through our entire agenda. So the last item, the one related to the cost drivers for higher ed, we're going to postpone. We'll deal with it when we come back in February. Very important conversation, but yes, you know, we need time to really look at it. So
thank you.
Don't feel that you have to make way for them.
Okay.
Thank you.
We also wanted to talk about some takeaways from the work we've done so far on the task force for the committee. I think especially considering the barriers we've identified, which is most of the work we've done so far is concentrated on those, using those as potential guideposts or basis for the future achievement compacts and programs that we'll be looking to fund. And we think that to reach student institutional success, we're going to need to address these barriers and make sure that our programs and the way that we fund higher post-secondary education is
driving at some of those. The recommendations that we come up in our in our final report in October will be looking at both short-term and long-term solutions. So actions that we can take from elsewhere that might not have significant costs. So identifying best practices from other places that we could bring to Oregon and bring to the work we're doing. We also are going to be looking at steps that can be taken without additional funding but could result in doing less of something else. So how can we change what we're currently doing using the resources we have? How can we shift our resources and improve the work we're doing? Programmatic elements that would need to be funded in 2013-2015 biennium. So we've discussed some of the programs, and we'll continue that discussion throughout the rest of the year on what programs are most essential in reaching 40-40-20 and the goals that we want for our post-secondary education system. And then also discussing legislative changes that might be needed to remove some of the significant barriers that we've identified and to create alternative funding models. And I think that piece ultimately is about how our recommendations can lead us to understand the bigger picture better and how on a big picture level we need to approach our system and our goals.
Very good. So kind of what's next for the committee? We will begin our work again following the legislative session. In fact, we will be, I think, the first part of February, we are attending a conference in Portland on student and institutional success. We have a panel on that at that conference, and we'll be presenting. And then the committee will meet immediately after that conference, and we'll begin our work for the rest of the year. And we'll be looking at winnowing down those barriers to a manageable size, so that we can accomplish that. And many of the things that Ben has already included. And then we will also, one of the things that we will be doing, we'll be doing some around the state hearings of the report to gather their information and to give them a chance to react to it and give us further feedback on it. And then with that, submitting a final report, I believe, for October 1st. With that, I guess we would go to kind of a final question. And that would be, how can the work of the task force be of assistance to you as you move forward with your work?
Thank you, gentlemen. Thoughts on that question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say that I think the findings of the group and the recommendation of the group will be helpful for the OEIB as we go through the process of assembling these achievement compacts with community colleges, with the university system, and so forth. And I think it'll be instructive and helpful for that. So there'll be a lot of good information delving from best practices to, you know, aspirational goals, all that kind of stuff. But I think it'll be really helpful in the process as we advance, you know, the reform agenda that's underway in the state right now.
Super.
And it's a pleasure to serve with both of you on that as well.
Other thoughts, reactions, colleague? Great. Well, I just, you know, like to thank you for coming forward and for the work that you're doing on it. I do think that the topics that are coming out, whether they're related to closing the access gap, both ethnic, regional, college-going culture, how to close those gaps, how to make sure that our students who need remediation, you know, in their basic skills, are getting what they need, and then are able to move successfully into career technical or transfer programs, to look at those barriers that are keeping people from being able to, support a family and work at the same time that they're in school, those real world kind of barriers, what we can do to make that easier for them. I think that is going to be a lot of the work that this committee is going to have to look at over the next few years. You know, it's certainly we can talk a lot about, and we will talk a lot about structures and governance and those kinds of things. It's critical. It's very important. But equally important is, how to, you know, make real-world differences for real-world people, removing those obstacles that are keeping them from being successful. So I look forward to the further refinement of the work.
As do we.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, I will close this informational hearing, reporting on 3418 Task Force. Colleagues, Rep. Johnson?
Just one comment, Mr. Chair and committee. I guess when we assemble next for our organizational meeting on February 1st, in addition to approving the committee rules and so forth, we'll have the opportunity, I think, to perhaps have be ready for a work session on maybe one of our committee bills so that we can begin our work early. So be ready for that, and we'll let you know what that topic will be.
Yeah. And then, expect early on public hearings on the Western Governors. I think we're looking at that for Tuesday, February 8th. Textbooks, perhaps the Thursday of the week before. And we do want to get to our report on cost drivers for higher ed.
Yeah.
So, any final comments or questions? Thank you for your patience, colleagues and audience. And I will close today's public hearing of the Higher Education, this meeting of the Higher Education Committee.